Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
There's been a bus parked outside of NBC today. It's a red, white, and blue bus, all colors, and it says, "I'm the greatest." Now, I'm going to make my little speech first, and you do as you please about it. This is all very colorful and very funny and everything. I'm not happy unless I tell you my own impression. He is a very nice young man, a well-mannered young man, and I found him to be quietly very humble. Don't you think so?
Absolutely.
Now, he insists on doing this wild act, so we'll go along with it. But I don't like to be part of an act because I like the guy to be real. He happens to talk this way when he's on front of an audience, but he can talk very quiet and sensibly. I'd like you to meet, perhaps, ladies and gentlemen, the next world's champion of the Lexington YMCA. A grand young man. I hope the next champion of the United States. Why not? Cassius Clay.
Well, he has been lifting weights.
Yeah, this is Miss Miller.
Sit down. Oh, this, excuse me, I'm so rude. This is Miss Miller.
Yes, ma'am.
You know Miss Miller, don't you? You ever hear of her? Well, she's a lovely lady, anyhow. Ma'am, I was surprised to learn, you know, because I've gone along with the cliche, you know, that you're all a product of poetry and everything, but I didn't know that you were United States Olympic boxing champ. 1959 and 1960,
national golden... United States Olympic champion, world Olympic champion. I had to...
Oh, now you've gone too far.
Before...
Honestly, you were?
I had to beat everybody in the United States to qualify for the whole...
Are you the world's?
The world, gold medal winner, right.
Well, now, how about that? 1959 and 1960 National Golden Gloves Championship, 1959 and 1960 National AAL Champ.
AAU.
I didn't know you were with the union. Listen, tell me, Cassius, how many fights you had?
Oh, about 180 amateur fights. Lost three. That was my first three, by the way.
Yeah. Have you ever been knocked out? Have you ever been knocked out?
Never dreamed of being knocked out.
Do you really think, you feel confident that
there's,
you'll...
There's not a man in the world to beat me. I'm as pretty as Liberace, and he's not...
You know, you are a very good-looking boy. Where did you start boxing? Why did you start boxing?
I started boxing in Louisville, Kentucky.
Why?
2 years ago.
Tell me the nice little
12
story.
12 years ago, someone stole my bicycle.
I
said that if I ever catch the guy, I'm going to beat him up, but I never did catch him.
You never did?
No, but...
And you feel that you possibly could
I'm getting ready to fight the roughest and the toughest man in the world.
Sonny Liston.
Right.
And you feel you have a chance?
If he dreamed he beat me, he would apologize.
Yes. you really feel that strongly about it.
That's right. Sonny Liston rather take off his sport coat, soak it in gasoline, and run through hell before he fight me.
I notice he's backing away all the time. I feel
after I retire from the ring, I'm going to be a great singer. I'm getting ready to cut a record with Columbia now.
Oh. I saw the album cover.
Right.
He's wearing one of my
album
old suits.
Right.
Yeah.
I have album.
It's the right color, too, I think, don't you?
I heard the show was in Technicolor.
Yeah. Listen, you really think you're going to win this fight? And that'll be fine. Now, tell me, how much money all told, will you make out of this fight?
Well, I don't.
Will you win or lose? Well, you get the same if you win or lose?
It's a percentage deal, you know, but...
You figured it out in your head.
They figure probably they might draw a few people. Maybe they might have a $15 million gate that night.
$15 million. How much of that would you get?
About three. Ain't that a shame?
$3 million. Well, $3 million. Now, how much is taxable?
About $2,500,000.
Sure, man. How much do your backers and those guys get?
Oh, we have a 50-50 contract, but...
You want to get $250,000? You'll get about $250,000 if they get half of what's left? Or would you rather not discuss it? Or you'll discuss it. None of my business.
Hey, Cash, hey.
What?
Cassius, if you lose the fight, you can cry all the way to the bank with me. Okay?
All right?
You've done pretty well.
Now he's going to win.
But I never think of losing. Don't even talk about it.
That's right.
Are you scared?
No, scared my prediction might not come off. I predict around 8 to prove I'm great. If he keeps talking jive, he'll fall in 5.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, August 19th, 2016. So I have been told this is our 6th study session on Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. We are picking up on Chapter 11, the book co-authored by two racist suspects, Johnny Smith, Randy Roberts. We will not take any more time. The audio segment you heard at the beginning, that was from the Jack Parr Show. That's like one of those talk shows, I guess something akin to what you would have on Letterman or that sort of thing from way, way back. This is before Muhammad Ali was heavyweight champion, 1963, when this originally aired. I think you can get the entire segment on DVD. I'm sure it might even be available online. But without any further ado, context to white supremacy, Blood Brothers, the fatal friendship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X, audio segment number 1.
Chapter 11, The Crusade. It's widely believed that there are more people in the world who understand Einstein's theory than think Cassius Clay has a chance. Jim Murray. Beethoven wrote some of his greatest symphonies when he was deaf. Why couldn't Cassius Clay fight when he was blind? Ferdy Pacheco. A hard, cold wind blew in from the west, dumping a few inches of snow in northern Florida and whipping rain across Biscayne Bay toward the resorts of Miami Beach. Sonny Liston had an ideal view of the storm. He and Geraldine were sharing a palatial 16-room beach house on Biscayne Bay with Joe Lewis and his wife. Together, Sonny and Joe, two of the most laconic champions in the history of the division, could watch the stinging rain swirl around the hotel towers, pockmarking the sand on the beach. It was 2 days before the title match, and Liston had finished his training and was now hunkered down with his thoughts. He never had much to say, and even less in the days before a fight. Hungry for some news from Liston's inner circle, reporters turned to Lewis. Sonny would win, Joe predicted confidently. He called Clay a good amateur boxer who had never mastered professional tactics. He might last a few rounds if he ran like a rabbit, but eventually Sonny would catch him. Though it was just a short drive from Liston's quarters to Cassius Clay's tiny white house on Fifth Street in a low-rent district of North Miami, the two neighborhoods were worlds apart. Clay's place had cheap louvered windows and a porch so small that only one chair could fit on it. The inside of his house matched the porch. It was tiny and crowded. A mob of men, some with the thinnest ties to his camp, slept dormitory-style, 3 or 4 to a room. Children slammed doors as they ran, laughing and screaming, in and out of the house, and the smells of cooking greens and beans soaked every room. Outside, in a dusty patch of lawn along Fifth Street, men sat in cheap folding chairs under a large ficus tree, talking and watching foxes stroll up and down the street. Often in the evenings, as soon as the moon rose over the city, an aide strung an extension cord out of a window and set up a movie projector and a white sheet screen. Kids gathered on the lawn, pulling their knees close to their chests to make room for a capacity audience. While moths gathered in the light of the flickering film, Clay narrated a voiceover commentary of the action on the screen. He had watched all the movies repeatedly and enjoyed preparing everyone for the plot twists. One movie silenced even Cassius. He showed it three or four times, and on each occasion he watched in hushed, wide-eyed respect. Only the slow crawl of traffic intruded on the film, the 1956 science fiction horror classic Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The story of pods from somewhere in outer space that replicate and replace humans, transforming them into mindless, soulless automatons, transfixed the fighter. A few white sports writers and journalists visited Clay in his Fifth Street quarters. They wrote about the chaos, the cast of characters that included jesters, trainers, hangers-on, and somber, angry-eyed, intimidating men in dark suits, white shirts, and bow ties who watched the action around them and hardly had a good word to say to any white man. Other members of Clay's camp referred to them as the Brotherhood. But they looked to the white reporters like a sect of pod people. They dressed alike, acted alike, talked alike, and seemed to think alike. Malcolm X, the physical prototype for the Brotherhood, returned to Miami on February 24th, the day before the fight. Once again, Cassius, along with Archie Robinson, picked him up at the airport. No sooner was Malcolm in the car than Clay inquired about his standing in the nation. "Any word from Chicago?" he asked. Of course, there had been. Elijah's personal secretary had told Malcolm that his suspension was still in effect and that the Supreme Minister remained deeply disturbed by his disciples' independent ways. But instead of telling the full truth, Malcolm answered deceptively, "Nothing positive," and let it go at that. He said it cheerfully, in a sort of no-news-is-good-news tone of voice, yet he knew that nothing positive translated to everything negative. Outwardly, Malcolm looked as cool as ever, smiling as if he knew a secret nobody else did, as if fear were an alien concept. But that night, when Cassius left him at the Hampton House, he did not visit the hotel's jazz club. He sat in his room, plotting his future. At the heart of his plan was Cassius Clay. It all depended on Clay defeating Liston. Malcolm believed that Allah had delivered Cassius to him. And Allah would not have brought the two together in that Detroit luncheonette, shown the boxer the light of truth, and allowed him to ascend to the top of the heavyweight division, only to abandon him now. Surely, if he could talk to Elijah, he could convince him of the divine importance of the match in Miami. Early on the day of the contest, Malcolm phoned Chicago. Whether he talked directly with Elijah or one of the prophet's leading aides is unclear from the FBI informant's report. But it hardly mattered. Chicago was Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm and Elijah engaged in a conversation, even if it traveled through a third person. Malcolm repeated his absolute belief that Clay would defeat Liston, making the boxer potentially the nation's most important convert and marketable asset. What would the heavyweight champion be worth in terms of world prestige, propaganda, and revenues? What would be the value of his image on the pages of Muhammad Speaks, and how much power would it carry among young black men stifled in the ghettos of America? Could Elijah imagine the waves of emotion that would roll across the auditorium when Malcolm, yes, Malcolm, delivered Cassius and the title to the Supreme Minister at the Savior's Day Convention on February 26th? It would mark a new age for the Nation of Islam and elevate Elijah to new heights, and all it would cost was Malcolm's full reinstatement. Chicago turned him down flat. Clearly, Elijah, Raymond Sharif, and the other Muslim leaders thought that Malcolm was daydreaming. They agreed with the experts that Liston would dispatch Clay in a few rounds, ending the meteoric rise of the boisterous contender. Once defeated, and possibly even humiliated, he would be just another boxer, battered, scarred, on the road to oblivion. Malcolm, they judged, was as bad at evaluating boxers as he was sizing up political infighters. What was more, if by some chance Clay did upset Liston, the nation was prepared to push Malcolm out of the picture and claim Cassius as their own, reaping all the rewards. While Malcolm tried to barter Clay for his reinstatement, Cassius prepared for the final act in his psychological campaign against Liston. A few days before, he had told the press, "I'm tired of talking. I'm ready to go to war." But he had one more set piece planned before he stepped into the ring. At precisely 10:30 a.m., he burst into the Cypress Room in the Miami Convention Center for the weigh-in. Cassius wore a blue denim jacket with "Bear Huntin'" embroidered in red, carried a bamboo cane given to him by Malcolm, and appeared highly agitated. Drew Bundini Brown and Sugar Ray Robinson flanked him. Sugar Ray looked a bit sheepish, like a man who had been stationed in the center stage for no apparent reason. Bundini, however, played his part in the farce with consummate professionalism. Dressed in a yellow plaid sports jacket, fit for a Las Vegas showroom, he appeared wide-eyed and wild, a sweating, mumbling, shouting provocateur, ready to burst with excitement. Bundini, Angelo Dundee claimed, charged Clay's battery. Together with Cassius, he exhorted, "Float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. Rumble, young man, rumble. Ah! Rumble, young man, rumble." They repeated the lines again and again, admiring each other's performance and stretching out the open-mouthed "Ah!" to remarkable lengths. Jim Murray of the Los Angeles Times thought Cassius acted like Donald Duck on a bender. As Cassius ranted, his voice rose higher and then turned hoarse with strain. "I'm ready to rumble. I'm the champ. I'm ready to rumble," he kept repeating. "You can tell Sonny I'm here with Sugar Ray," he yelled. "Liston is flat-footed, and Joe Lewis is flat-footed, but me and Sugar Ray are two pretty dancers." While Robinson shifted about uneasily, Cassius continued, "Round eight, I'll prove I'm great." Then the spaniel-eyed Bundini joined in for another chorus of "Float like a butterfly and sting like a bee." William Faversham, the main representative of the Louisville sponsoring group, waded into the middle of the activity to restore order. He was soon in over his head. Having recently suffered from heart problems, his futile, hectic efforts to pull Clay out of the mess threatened his life. When Clay and his group retired to a dressing room to strip down for the weigh-in, the exhausted Faversham turned to LSG lawyer Gordon Davidson and told him to take over. "Gordon," he instructed, "go back to the dressing room and tell Clay that if he causes a scene, they're going to fine him, and it's going to be his money, not ours. Tell him to behave himself." Davidson pushed through the crowded room and into the dressing room. He found Clay lying on a rubdown table, relaxed and serene. "Cassius looked like he didn't have a worry in the world," he remembered, "like it was just another day at the office." Davidson warned Cassius that the boxing commission was going to fine him. "They're going to hit you pretty good." Clay brushed off the threat like it was a lone raindrop on his shoulder. "Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it." It was the cost of doing business, he figured, and not worth a second thought. Davidson's effort to domesticate Clay by threatening him with a fine was as pointless as telling Malcolm X not to express an opinion. For half an hour, first Davidson and then Faversham talked to Cassius about proper behavior and decorum. All the while, in the Cypress Room, hundreds of reporters and cameramen jockeyed for position for the show. At 11:09, when Davidson led Clay, Bundini, and Sugar Ray out of the dressing room, it seemed like a scene from a Hollywood premiere. The place pulsated with flashes from camera bulbs. Wearing a terrycloth robe and trunks, Cassius moved through the throng toward the weigh-in platform. Then Liston emerged from his dressing room. Cassius exploded. Excitedly, he jumped up and down, screaming, "Hey, sucker, you a chump! Are you scared?" He hollered that he was the real champ, that Liston had not fought anybody, and that he would knock him out. He promised, "Somebody's gonna die at ringside tonight." Cassius was uncontrollable. One reporter commented that Sugar Ray and Bundini patted him on the shoulders as if they were trying to calm a skittish colt and grabbed him around the waist to keep him away from Liston, but Clay continued to rage and shout and threaten. Liston observed the scene with cold disinterest. Once, he cupped his enormous hands over his mouth and said mysteriously, "Don't let anybody know. Don't tell the world." Know what? That Cassius was crazy? That he was a fool? That he was afraid? Interpretations of his cryptic statement varied. The comment threw Clay into an even wilder rage. Watching the action, reporter Mort Scharnick thought that there was no way that the boxer could fight that night. "It looked to me like Cassius was having a seizure," he recalled. Then he witnessed something strange, something that few others saw. While five or six people in his entourage were struggling to keep Clay from attacking Liston, he winked at Robinson. At the absolute center of the chaos, surrounded by cameras, shouting, and confusion, Cassius was probably having a ball. Weighing 218 pounds, Liston was a few pounds heavier than expected, and at 210.5, Clay was a few pounds lighter. But the numbers that seemed to matter most were 80 and 120. On the platform, where bedlam reigned, Liston's resting pulse rate registered 80 beats a minute, up slightly from his normal 72. Clay's normal rate was 54, but it had rocketed to 120. That alarmed Dr. Alexander Robbins, the attending physician. "Clay is nervous and scared, and he's burning a lot of energy," he said. Later, sportswriter Jimmy Cannon pressed him to elaborate on the comment, asking, "Could it be that the kid is scared to death, Doc?" Robbins said yes, and proceeded to venture well outside his professional competency. "He is hysterical. He has a fear of death, a fear of getting killed. He acted like a maniac. He's definitely out of control. He acted like a man off the beaten path." Clay's performance at the weigh-in ticked the odds against him up from 7-1 to 8-1. Some observers ventured even odds that he would not even show up for the fight. Most of the 400 to 500 onlookers would have agreed with Jim Murray that Cassius looked like a man who had just seen his own ghost. Rumors circulated that he was high on reefers, Benzedrine, or both. Most reporters agreed that Clay was too intelligent not to know that the gig was up. No man could have seen Clay that morning at the weigh-in and believed that he could stay on his feet 3 minutes that night, concluded the New Republic's Murray Kempton. The Miami Beach Boxing Commission fined Clay $2,500 for his conduct on the platform. Hours away from facing the most feared fighter in the world, Clay, many reporters insisted, must be nearly paralyzed with fear. Jimmy Cannon openly questioned his manhood. "Cassius was shaped for a more effete and gayer line," he wrote, speculating that the big riddle is, will he fall apart in the dressing room? Cannon and the others were reading into Clay their own fears of Liston, rather than listening to what the challenger said. Cassius brimmed with confidence, affirming his masculinity and promising retribution against the army of journalistic naysayers. "I don't know what it feels like to be afraid," he told Leonard Coppett of the New York Times. "The only thing I fear is fear itself. I'm going to win and be champion, and you writers better get on the bandwagon right now. If you're voting for me, write it now. I'm keeping lists." He was reading the papers, noting the doubters, and filing the information. "Right after the fight, I'm going to have my roll call, right there in the ring." Although 59 of 62 riders polled picked Liston to win the fight, generally by a knockout before the end of the third round, Clay was blithely confident, an attitude that Malcolm buttressed. Malcolm told him that it was the will of Allah that he would win, arguing that it was all part of a divine plan. The night before the fight, he told journalist Murray Kempton that Cassius feared no man. "To be a Muslim is to know no fear." George Plimpton wanted to discover more about the source of Clay's fearlessness. After the weigh-in spectacle, he took a car ride with Archie Robinson, who asked if he would like to meet Malcolm X. Plimpton said certainly, and Robinson drove him to the Hampton house. He took a side table in the luncheonette, and soon Malcolm walked in, carefully weaving through the crowded room, tapping the floor with a walking stick, identical to Clay's. Wearing horn-rimmed glasses, Malcolm stood tall, giving the appearance of a stately professor. He sat across from Plimpton, opening a package of peppermints and popping one in his mouth. He was as serene as a monk. The troubles keeping him awake at night were invisible to Plimpton. He said his problems with Elijah Muhammad were over. In fact, he would be unmuzzled in March, less than a week away. Speaking gently, occasionally he jotted a word or two that he wanted to emphasize on the paper tablecloth. Plimpton watched him write, noticing the red ring with a small crescent on one of his thin fingers. Malcolm was polite, repeating, "Sir?" when he did not hear a question in the noisy room, but Plimpton detected a slight mocking air about his fastidious manners. He affirmed his belief that Clay was likely to beat Liston. Again, Malcolm stressed the importance of belonging to the Muslim faith. "Cassius has tremendous self-confidence," he explained. "I've never heard him mention fear. Anything you're afraid of can whip you. Fear magnifies what you're afraid of. One thing about our religion is that it removes fear. Christianity is based on fear." Malcolm spoke respectfully, even lovingly, about Cassius, ignoring his athletic talents and concentrating on his intellectual and emotional assets. The boxer was kind, gentle, and humble, not at all like the clown that he played for public consumption. But the minister thought his pupil's greatest gift was his political instinct. "He should be a diplomat. He has the instinct of seeing a tricky situation shaping and resolving how to sidestep it." Perhaps it was that ability, the fighter's instinct for avoiding the knockout punch, that Malcolm most admired. Malcolm had always been a magnificent debater, but maybe he was realizing that he gave too much of himself away when he talked, that he showed his weaknesses to his most observant opponents. He admired in Cassius the very quality that he lacked. Clay talked endlessly, but had the ability to keep his options open. Meanwhile, Malcolm's options were closing. Officially silenced, instructed to avoid the press and to make no public statements, he continued to pop peppermints in his mouth and discuss black rage and revolution with Plimpton. The day of reckoning would come, he emphasized. There must be retribution. It was proclaimed in the Quran, chapter 20, verse 102. Later, Plimpton checked the citation. "The day when the trumpet is blown, on that day we will assemble the guilty, wide-eyed, with terror." "These are the things you are teaching Cassius?" Plimpton asked. Malcolm answered, "He will make up his own mind." Rain pelted the Miami Beach Convention Center on the day of the fight, washing away any chance William McDonald had of seeing a profit. After paying too much, $625,000, for the rights to the live promotion alone, he had no part of the lucrative closed-circuit television rights. He had compounded the error by scaling ticket prices too high. They ranged from $250 for the Golden Circle seats located just behind the press rows to $20 for seats high up in the arena and far from the ring. High rollers, the sort who came to fights to be seen as much as to see, had quickly bought the Golden Circle seats, and the cheap seats moved briskly. But the tickets for the mid-range seats, those priced at $200, $150, and $100, gathered dust in the offices of the convention center. McDonald refused to discount the ducats, hoping that when this inescapable fact sank in, there would be a late rush of buyers. But the hard rain, combined with McDonald's hard line, thoroughly dampened the sales. In the end, McDonald sold only 8,297 of the 15,744 seats in the arena. Altogether, he lost in the neighborhood of $363,000 on the venture. The rain and ticket prices were not the only obstacles for the gate. The contest was generally judged by boxing authorities to be a gross mismatch. When Robert Lipsight was sent to Miami, his elders at the New York Times had only one practical instruction. As soon as I landed, I was to drive my rental car from the arena to the nearest hospital, mapping the quickest route. My paper didn't want me to waste any deadline time following Clay to intensive care. Lipsight's seniors in the profession probably already knew the ambulance route. Writing columns about the fight that seemed penned in acid, Jim Murray's only hope for Cassius Clay is that he clots easily. Offering a strategy to the challenger, Murray wrote, "If I were Cassius Clay, I would fight him at such a long range, he would have to reach me through Western Union." It seemed that the only people willing to go on record predicting a win by Clay were close family members and a smattering of associates of Malcolm X. Meanwhile, the stories about Clay's connections with the Nation of Islam had worked a public relations miracle. They had transformed Sonny Liston into the sentimental favorite. Long before, Liston had accepted his role as the villain in the morality plays of professional boxing, but Clay's extreme religious and political opinions had made the champion's peccadilloes seem almost quaint. In a classic understatement, sports writer Dan Parker commented, "Liston hasn't been a popular champion, but since Clay's yen for the black Muslim white-hating sect of fanatics was revealed, neither is Cassius a popular challenger." The rain, the ticket prices, the expected mismatch, and the unpopularity of both fighters created a perfect storm for the fight's promoters. Capping it off, just an hour or so before the fight, a local radio station reported that Clay had been seen at the Miami airport purchasing a ticket for a foreign country. Jerry Eisenberg, covering the fight for the Newark Star-Ledger, heard the news in a taxi while he was riding to the match. The bizarre twists and turns of the Liston-Clay saga had left even him dizzy. "I didn't know what was going to happen. No one did. Maybe there would be a fight, maybe there wouldn't. Maybe Clay was in Miami. Maybe he was somewhere over the Atlantic, heading who knows where." Eisenberg heard him before he saw him. When the reporter reached his seat, a familiar voice knifed through the silence in the near-deserted arena. "Keep your left hand up! Keep your left hand up! Move to your right!" Turning around, Eisenberg spotted Cassius Clay, dressed in a tight tuxedo and a white ruffled shirt, his eyes trained on the ring, where his brother Rudy was making his professional debut in a 4-round preliminary bout. As he watched his brother, Cassius ducked and weaved, rolled with the punches, and threw a few in return, agonizing over any blow that connected with Rudy. When the referee raised Rudy's hand at the end of the contest, Cassius slipped out of the exit and hurried to his dressing room. Rudy's victory seemed to momentarily calm Clay. Dr. Robbins made a perfunctory pre-fight examination, noting that Clay's pulse had dropped to 64. But no sooner did he begin to relax than new concerns troubled his mind. Told repeatedly by the Muslims that he could not trust any white man, he fretted that some vast conspiracy of Caucasians was plotting his defeat. Looking at Pacheco and Angelo Dundee, his white corner men, he thought they might be part of the cabal. Angelo, according to Clay's tortured logic, was Italian, and an Italian must be associated with the Mafia, which certainly had a stake in Liston's keeping the title. After all, it was no secret that the mob controlled Sonny. They, whoever they were out to get him, Cassius reasoned. But how? Doping him by making him ingest some odorless, tasteless, colorless, debilitating drug seemed a logical guess. It had happened before. Fixers had doped water bottles, oranges, and towels to drug a fighter. And all day Cassius had received calls from black Muslims warning him to beware of the white devils. Shouldn't he at least consider the possibility? As he waited in the dressing room, weaving a web of suspicions, the water bottle assumed an ominous presence. He dumped out the water and refilled it himself, taping it shut and assigning Rudy to make sure no one got near it. But Rudy had just won his first pro fight, and his attention lagged behind his intention. When Cassius noticed this, he again emptied, filled, and taped the bottle. "He did that 3 or 4 times," recalled Pacheco. Cassius was nervous. For all he had said about his opponent being a chump, Boxing authorities claimed that Sonny Liston was one of the two or three greatest, maybe the best, heavyweight champions in history. Big, mean, and vicious, he had hurt most of his opponents, knocking out the finest boxers in the division. Even as Masseur Luis Saria rubbed Clay's shoulders, Pacheco noticed that the fighter was tight. He was just a kid, and that night he had no idea if he could really do what he had been saying he could do all along. Almost providentially, someone knocked on the door. Malcolm X came into the dressing room, exuding a sense of cool confidence. Malcolm, Cassius, and Rudy faced east toward Mecca, bowed, and prayed, praising Allah and blessing his name. Then Malcolm repeated a variation of what he had been saying since coming to Miami. It was more a prophecy than a pep talk. The fight is the truth. It's the cross and the crescent fighting in the prize ring for the first time. It's a modern crusades, a Christian and a Muslim facing each other with television to beam it off Telstar for the whole world to see what happens. This was destined to be a historic moment. Do you think Allah has brought about all this, intending for you to leave the ring as anything but the champion? When he had completed his mission, Malcolm walked back to his seat near ringside, stopping briefly to chat with the singer Sam Cooke, who was seated close to Malcolm in row 7. He moved to seat number 7, a lucky seat. 7, along with 12 and 21, were the three numbers that Elijah Muhammad taught were special for the Asiatic black man. The date of the fight also had significance. It was the 25th day of February. 2 plus 5 equaled 7. And the following day would be the 34th Savior's Day convention. Again, 3 plus 4 equaled 7. Believing fully in the power and meaning of numbers, Malcolm must have smiled, at least inwardly. I took this to be Allah's message, confirming to me that Cassius Clay was going to win, he later told Alex Haley. When Cassius, wearing a stylish thigh-length white robe, slipped through the ropes into the ring, the convention center looked as if it were an experiment in economic segregation. The Golden Circle seats were practically full, celebrities packed next to each other and to other wealthy ticket holders willing to pay top dollar just to sit close to them. And far from them, up high in the hinterlands of the arena, sat the $20 and $50 patrons. Between the two classes of spectators was a cordon sanitaire, row after row of $100 to $200 seats that were so sparsely populated that they looked as if they had been designed as a physical barrier. In his corner, Cassius was nervous, like a person who had ventured too far out on a high limb. When he met Sonny in the middle of the ring for the referee's instruction, he later admitted, "I was scared. Sonny Liston was the greatest fighter of all time, and he was fixing to kill me. It frightened me, just knowing how hard he hit." Meanwhile, his opponent came into the ring as unfeeling as a rock. His head had been partially covered by the hood of his white robe, but when the fighters met in the center of the ring and Sonny removed the hood, he fixed Clay with a malevolent stare. In the previous 3 years, Liston had fought 4 times, winning 3 by knockouts in the first round and once by knockout in the 3rd round. Barry Gotterer wrote in Sport magazine that Liston commanded the center of the ring. A former convict, a one-time Union goon, and a man who seemed drawn to violence, Liston had assumed the aura of a superman, a destroyer who came to kill. Clay's trepidation was understandable. Most boxers know fear. The greats rise above it and execute their fight plans anyway. Cassius planned to exploit Sonny's age and overconfidence. He knew that Liston expected another short fight and had not wasted much energy training. Clay's plan was to make Liston chase him, fighting in spurts and circling constantly to his left, away from Liston's lethal left hand. Clay later recalled, "I trained to fight the first 2 rounds and to protect myself from getting hit by Liston. I knew that with the 3rd, he'd start tiring, then he'd get worse with every round. So I trained to coast the 3rd, 4th, and 5th rounds. I wanted him to wear himself out and get desperate. He would be throwing wild punches and missing. and so I conditioned myself to fight full steam from the sixth through the ninth round. Cassius thought by the eighth he would have Liston. I'd cut him up and shake him up until he would be like a bull, just blind, and missing punches until he was nearly crazy. And when he had thrown some punch and left himself just right, I'd be all set, and I'd drop him. That, anyway, was the plan. Waiting in his corner for the opening bell, Cassius danced, gracefully shifting his weight from one foot to the other. Sonny scraped his feet against the canvas, like a bull digging into the dirt before charging. At the clang of the bell, he attacked, moving toward Clay in a straight line as if they were fighting on a tightrope. Yet, while Sonny's assault was linear, Cassius's defense was rococo. His hands at his side, he bounced, tantalizing, just beyond the champion's reach, slipping, ducking, sidestepping, and pulling back from punches. All the while, Cassius circled left, making it difficult for Sonny to land a left jab and impossible to connect with a left hook. Liston lunged like an amateur, missing hooks by several feet. When he got too close, Clay briefly clinched and then quickly pushed him back to a safe distance. For the first half of the round, Clay hardly threw a punch. He dominated simply by the artistry of his movement. Forward, backward, side to side, feinting up and down, the complexity of his defense baffled Liston. Cassius, wrote Edwin Pope of the Miami Herald, moved like a kid on a pogo stick. He backed into corners and then slithered out of them so adroitly that Liston was still moving forward when Clay was already brushing by. The harder the champion tried, the more awkward he looked. Then, Clay began to jab. At first, he threw snake-tongue jabs designed to gauge the distance from his prey and then get a sense of Liston's reaction. Feeling safe, he tried a few harder jabs, mixing in a couple of cruel, flat-footed lead rights and left hooks that stopped Liston's forward movement. Angered, the champion charged, fighting wildly even after the bell. Although most of the spectators reacted with a communal exhale to Liston's thunderous misses, the more discerning fight fans watched as Clay dominated the action. Between rounds, color commentator Joe Lewis was characteristically stingy with his observations, but also perfectly accurate. "I think this is one of the greatest rounds that we have seen in a long time. I think Clay completely outclassed Sonny Liston," he told his ringside colleague Steve Ellis. But, the Brown Bomber concluded, if Clay got too confident, Liston would knock him out. Sonny pressed hard in the second. He threw more body punches, hoping to take some of the speed out of Cassius's legs, but he had no better luck reaching Clay's body than he had hitting his head. Cassius remained at a safe distance. "Liston came at me throwing everything," he later recalled. "He was going to make up for looking so bad that I had lasted one round." While Clay moved, he watched Sonny's eyes, seeing in them his opponent's thoughts. "Liston eyes you up when he's about to throw a heavy punch," he said. "Some kind of way they just flicker." So Cassius watched, looking for the flicker, the warning to move out of range. But he saw something else, a soft red mouse high on Liston's left cheekbone. He knew that one or two sharp punches would split the bump wide open, proving to the experts, the spectators, and most important, Liston himself, that the champion could bleed like any other fighter. And if he could bleed, he could be defeated. Cassius threw and landed the first punches of the third. He had planned to coast that round, but saw that Liston was hurt and confused. He later explained, "I couldn't waste no time. I needed one more good shot for some insurance with that eye." His left jabs angled off Sonny's left eye. Then a right-left combination landed with tom-tom precision. Tex Mall of Sports Illustrated thought Cassius worked as methodically as a bullfighter, placing banderillas. Suddenly, it happened. A right hand split Sonny's cheek from dark to red as cleanly as a sharp knife cutting through the rind of a watermelon. "It didn't take but one good combination," Cassius recalled. "My left was square on his right eye, and a right under his left eye opened a deep gash. I knew it was deep, the way the blood spurted right out. Then Cassius opened up, throwing left and right hooks. While a nearly electric shock jolted the spectators to their feet, the blow-by-blow announcer reacted excitedly. "Sonny wobbled! Sonny wobbled! Cassius has him hurt! Sonny has a big mouse below the left eye, Sonny's cut below the eye, and he's getting hit with all the punches in the book!" Cassius watched as Sonny pawed at his eye. A cut under the eye, as Jerry Eisenberg commented, doesn't mean shit. But it did to Liston when he was the one who had been cut. Seeing blood on his glove, he rushed forward, throwing all of his weight into wild, wide punches. A few crashed painfully into Clay's body, but most missed, visibly tiring the champion. Jim Murray commented, "The old champ was as clumsy as a guy groping for a light switch in the dark, with a hangover." But several of the punches that missed whooshed just inches past Cassius's jaw. The thought of what might have been kept the spectators on their feet, roaring. From his press row seat, Maul watched Clay dismantle the Liston legend. The champion had no answer for Cassius's speed and tactics. At one point in the third round, Maul noticed Liston leaning heavily against the rope, peering between raised gloves. His expression was puzzled and shocked, and almost frightened. His arrogant self-confidence, the cornerstone of his awesome reputation, had vanished. And 6 feet away, Clay was screaming at him, "Come on! Come on, you bum!" At that moment, it was clear to Maul that Sonny Liston was no longer the heavyweight champion of the world. But the fight wasn't over yet. Sonny trudged to his corner like an aged sparring partner, collapsing hard onto his stool. His trainer, Willie Reddish, and cutman, Joe Polino, crowded in front of him. Polino immediately went to work on Liston's eye, sponging it clean and smearing Monsil solution, a thick caustic substance that's now illegal in boxing, on the wound. Monsil's dries quickly, leaves a black residue, and can be blinding if it gets into a fighter's eyes. Quite possibly, another blinding substance was put on Sonny's gloves. According to Jack McKinney, a Philadelphia sports writer sitting near Liston and Polino, when Sonny returned to his corner, he ordered Polino to juice the gloves, that is, smear some illegal substance on them. In several previous fights, Liston's opponents had complained that a painful astringent, perhaps from Sonny's gloves, had gotten into their eyes. McKinney claimed that Liston's corner man had a history of juicing his gloves and did it once again in the Clay fight. If you look at a film of what went on in Liston's corner between the third and fourth rounds of that fight, McKinney told writer Thomas Hauser, you'll see Polino in the ring with Willie Reddish standing behind him, blocking everyone's view, and Polino is at Sonny's knees, rubbing something on his glove. Round four belonged to Clay from start to finish. No longer was he moving in jerky pogo-stick bursts. Still circling Liston, he maneuvered more slowly, confidently, snapping out jabs that seemed to explode in Sonny's face. Soon, Liston's right eye had an angry welt under it, and his nose and lips looked like he was having an allergic reaction to multiple bee stings. Sonny tried to respond, but his jabs consistently missed their target, and his hooks mostly punished the air around Cassius's head. Once, however, Liston forced a clinch, and although he could not punish Clay with punches, he rubbed his glove across Cassius's eyes. If his gloves were juiced, this is when he did the damage. Several sports writers thought that Cassius's jabs connected with the Monsil's on Sonny's left eye, and that then he transferred the substance to his forehead as he wiped off sweat. The thin skin of the caustic on his forehead, wrote Maul, washed down into his eyes between rounds when his trainer, Angelo Dundee, swabbed him with a wet sponge. The trouble with this view is that Cassius did not brush his forehead with his left, his primary punching hand, during the round. The only hand that swept across Clay's eyes and forehead was Liston's. Nor did Dundee contribute to the problem. By the time Clay reached his corner, his face was already contorted with pain. He felt like some acid was in his eyes. I could just see blurry. It felt like fire. Blinking as if he were trying to clear grit out of his eyes, he told Dundee that something was wrong. Removing his mouthpiece, he screamed at Dundee, Cut off the gloves! Cut off the gloves! At the time, Cassius believed that someone was trying to fix the fight. Dirty work afoot, he told Dundee. Dirty work afoot, he repeated to his other corner men. Dundee was not about to cut off Clay's gloves, not in a heavyweight championship contest. He quickly examined his fighter. I put my pinky in his eye and then mine, he recalled. It burned like hell. While Cassius complained, Dundee tried another test. He dried Clay's eyes with a towel, sniffing and tasting it when he finished. There was something wrong. I tasted a strange substance. Maybe it was from Liston's gloves. Perhaps it was something else that had been put on Sonny's body. Unconcerned with the cause, Dundee focused on the problem. He sponged Clay's eyes, trying to flush out whatever substance was in them. He tried to reassure him, telling Cassius that the pain would pass and that he would be fine. If you can't see, keep away from him until your eyes clear. This is the big one. Nobody walks away from a heavyweight championship. While Dundee was earning his wages in Clay's corner, black Muslims at ringside had reached their own conclusions about the cause of the problem. Eisenberg remembered that Captain Sam and Archie Robinson were out of their seats, watching Dundee wipe Clay's eyes while he convulsed in pain. They clearly believed that Dundee was the culprit. Seeing the rising anger of the Muslims, Chris Dundee signaled to his brother Angelo to wipe his own face with the sponge, which the trainer soon did, telling Archie and Sam, "Look, look, look!" But before that demonstration, he had a fighter to motivate. When the bell rang for round five, Cassius said Angelo pushed him forward and shouted, "This is the big one, Daddy! We aren't going to quit now! Run until your eyes clear! Run!" As Clay moved forward, half blind and confused, Bundini Brown offered a piece of tactical advice. "Yardstick him, champ! Yardstick him!" It was the perfect strategy. Often in previous fights, Clay had used his left, held straight out from his shoulder, as a yardstick for measuring distance and punches, and occasionally for taunting opponents. Now, he could use his straight yardstick left as a seeing-eye device. As long as Liston remained an arm's length away from him, Cassius was in safe territory. Liston eyed Clay at the start of the fifth round, like a kid looks at a new bike on Christmas. Seeing Cassius's condition, he rushed forward with cruel intentions. Instead of maneuvering to cut off the ring and force Clay into a corner, he moved directly toward him, like an aggressive street brawler stalking a frightened victim. Cassius moved backward, unable to completely avoid Sonny's bull rushes. But he could grab and hold, thereby denying Liston leverage for his most lethal punches. But in the clinches, Clay absorbed frightful punishment. Liston pounded his sides and stomach with combinations. At one point, early in the fifth, Clay grabbed the back of Liston's neck and Sonny landed 16 consecutive body blows before the referee broke the clinch. Clay had no plans for fighting blind. More than other fighters, he boxed in a head-high, wide-eyed style. At times, he looked like a painter, stepping back to inspect his work before adding a final dab of color. But now, he was robbed of his vision, glimpsing Liston imperfectly through tear-fogged eyes. "Man, in that round, my plans were gone. I was just trying to keep alive, hoping the tears would wash out my eyes. I could open them just enough to get a good glimpse of Liston, and then it hurt so bad I blinked them closed again. He was trying to hit me square. It could be over, right there." There is a widely accepted myth that during the fifth, Clay's speed kept him out of harm's way. In truth, during the first 90 seconds of the round, Liston landed scores of punches, to the head as well as the body. Rather than his speed, Clay's ability to take a punch kept him in the fight. Soon after the match, Clay reflected, "He shook me with a left to the head and a lot of shots to the body. Now, I ain't too sorry it happened, because it proved I could take Liston's punching." Liston was snorting like a horse during his onslaught, Cassius remembered, but by the middle of the round, he was breathing heavily through his mouth. Arm-weary and bone-tired, he began to slow, throwing fewer punches, and those were mostly slow, lazy, and purposeless. In the clinches, he rested rather than pulling his arms free and banging Clay's body. Now, Cassius began yardsticking him, and as his eyes cleared, stung him with sharp jabs. He began to talk. "You ain't nothing." And to prove the point, he yardsticked Liston, and then slapped him lightly 5 or 6 times in the face, almost like a teenage boy playboxing with a 5-year-old, or, wrote Tex Mall, like a man knocking on a door. Sonny had thrown more punches in the first half of the round than he normally threw in 2 or 3, and now his lack of conditioning showed. For Sonny, the bell that ended the round came as a relief, even though it ended his best opportunity to win the fight. Nothing was working. Cassius Clay had weathered Liston's stare, intimidation tactics, bull rushes, juiced gloves, and best punches. The arm-weary, mouth-breathing champion had nothing left. No plan B, no second wind, no chance. Cassius had everything the champion lacked. As the result of hard conditioning and the advantages of youth, he felt the rise of a second wind as his eyes cleared and his confidence grew. "Get mad, baby," Dundee told him. He said to go for the knockout. "No," Clay answered. "I ain't in a hurry. Maybe I'll carry him for the 15. Taking his last deep breaths before round 6, Cassius knew, "I was going to make Liston look terrible." He did. Closing the distance to the champion, boxing at a slower, more deliberate pace, he started to punish Sonny. Steve Ellis described the action for the closed-circuit viewers. "We note that Sonny stands flat-footed most of the time. Easy target. Easy!" His voice rose on the second easy as Clay landed a punishing jab and a powerful right cross. Although Clay held his hands low, his boxing was classic. Every attack followed from his perfectly timed jab, always aimed at the cuts below Sonny's eyes. As Liston moved sluggishly forward, Clay jabbed, sometimes softly, as if he was just toying with Sonny, other times with jolting force. Depending on how Liston reacted to the jab, Clay might throw a right cross or a right-left-right combination of hooks. Then he backed away before Liston could set himself to counterpunch. "Sonny can't seem to slip or knock down that jab effectively," Ellis said. "Cassius throws it from all angles. Very tricky left lead." It was a textbook round. Clay knew that Liston had entered the pain zone, and there was nothing he could do about it. He was gone, Clay realized. Between rounds, Cassius twisted around and called to the reporters, "I'm gonna upset the world." "I never will forget how their faces was looking up at me like they couldn't believe it," he said later. But sitting close to the reporters was Malcolm X, and he believed it. He had prophesied it. Throughout the fight, he never lost faith, not even when Cassius fought blind in the 5th. Although inwardly Malcolm rejoiced, outwardly he was the picture of tranquility. "I folded my arms and tried to appear the coolest man in the place," he wrote, "because a television camera can show you looking like a fool, yelling at a prize fight." While Clay's confidence swelled, Liston's deflated, like a pinpricked balloon. Willie Reddish had to convince him to sit down at the end of the 6th. And while Joe Pollino labored to mend the fighter's cuts, the normally silent and undemonstrative Sonny jabbered about something. He stayed on his stool after the warning buzzer, and at the bell, Reddish turned to referee Barney Felix and made a slight, low gesture with his hands, the signal that his fighter was through. The match was over. Liston remained immobile on his stool, tears mingling with the blood below his eyes. On his feet at the buzzer, Cassius saw what was happening before Reddish's capitulation. "I happened to be looking right at Liston when the warning buzzer sounded, and I didn't believe it when he spat out his mouthpiece. And then someone just told me he wasn't coming out. It's a funny thing, but I wasn't even thinking about Liston. I was thinking about nothing but that hypocrite press. All of them down there had written so much about me, bound to get killed by the big fists." As Clay looked toward Liston's corner, he raised both arms high and broke into a jig, floating effortlessly in the center of the ring before Bundini embraced him in a bear hug. Then, his mouth wide open, he wriggled loose from Bundini's arms and made a mad dash toward the reporters. For the record, everyone in Liston's corner, and later a team of 8 doctors from St. Francis Hospital in Miami, insisted Sonny had torn a tendon in his left arm early in the fight. The blood had drained into his bicep and deadened his arm, they said. Sonny had wanted to continue, his manager, Jack Nylund, claimed. I made the decision. Before Sonny could protest, Willie and I stepped in front of him and waved the referee off. Sonny spit out his mouthpiece and cursed me and cursed Clay. I can beat the bastard one-handed, Liston supposedly said. And perhaps, as unlikely as it seems, he did not play any role in the decision to end the fight while slumped on his stool. Still, the fact that Clay was willing to fight blind and Liston refused to continue because of a sore shoulder tells much about both boxers. But the moment Reddish signaled Felix that his fighter was done, Sonny Liston became just another bruised, bloodied, beaten ex-champion, looking older than his age, whatever that was, and sadder than any ex-mob goon ever had. Surveying Liston's face, which looked like a melon that had fallen off the back of a truck, Murray thought it was possible to feel sorry for this mastodon. Clay's gate-crashing sprint for the reporters, however, grabbed all the attention away from Liston's suffering. He pulled away from his handlers, dodged well-wishers, and climbed like a squirrel onto the red velvet ropes. Perched above the multitude, he pointed with a still-gloved hand at the working press and commenced a long-repressed harangue. "I am the greatest!" he shouted. "I shook up the world! You hypocrites! You ought to hang your heads! Eat your words! Eat! Eat your words!" At ringside, Red Smith of the New York Herald Tribune took a large bite. He had confidently, even humorously and arrogantly, predicted Clay's defeat, and now he heard Cassius's response. "Nobody ever had a better right to tell reporters to eat their words," he wrote. "In a mouth still dry from the excitement of the most astonishing upset in many roaring years, the words don't taste good, but they taste better than they read. The words, written here and practically everywhere else until the impossible became the unbelievable truth, said Sonny Liston would squash Cassius Clay like a bug when the boy braggart challenged for the heavyweight championship of the world." Then, bounding off the ropes, Cassius veered toward the center of the ring, where he continued to shout his praises. "I am the greatest! I shook up the world!" He moved from radio announcers to television commentators, saying the same thing. Trapped for a minute by Steve Ellis and Joe Louis, Cassius announced, "I'm the greatest fighter who ever lived. I'm so great, I don't have a mark on my face. And I upset Sonny Liston, and I'm just 22 years old. I must be the greatest. I told the world. I talk to God every day. With God with me, can't nobody be against me." Ellis worked to ask a question and got a brief response. But Cassius was lost in his own world. "I'm a bad man. I shook up the world. I shook up the world. I shook up the world." Standing in row 7, seat 7, Malcolm X fixed his eyes on the man who shook up the world and talked with God. His God. The black man's God. Allah. It was part of his plan and Malcolm's. No longer could the Honorable Elijah Muhammad doubt the greatness of Cassius Clay. Now, in the ebullience of Miami, Cassius had won the most important and symbolic crown in all of sports, and Malcolm's was the voice in his ear. It must have seemed, at that moment, that Malcolm's deepest dreams were on the cusp of coming true.
Context of white supremacy. That is where we will pick up at. For the second audio segment will be Chapter 12. That was the end of Chapter 11. We'll be on Chapter 12, Free to Be Me. Folks have commentary they would like to share. Feel free to chime in. The number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. 888-343-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you don't want to use your phone, you still want to chime in, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at the Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.com/1race. That is the number one. The address again, tiny.com/1race. And that is the number one. When you put in the address, look on the left of the page. You will see the link. It says VOPE line. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The first line is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which, again, is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code, again, is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us, and it is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. You'll then hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. Do so, and then I'll see your hand. We will get you on the line. Right on. We will get to the phone line. If folks have commentary they would like to share, feel free to chime in. Please do not wait until the last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up. We have a good chunk of time for folks to share before we get to audio segment number 2. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Yes, I'm here.
I heard both of you. We'll start with Mr. Demery 4.
All right, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I found that this reading, first the title, I found it interesting, and then later on found that he used Malcolm X's phrase, calling the fight a modern crusade, as a title for this. But I guess the crusade referring to series of wars that European Christians waged against Muslims between the 11th and 15th century. But basically, you just had two black fighters, one raised by a Baptist mother and a Methodist father, who was basically confused about what he believed in, and Sonny Liston was influenced by Catholicism when the white priest in prison noticed, you know, that he had some type of fighting skills. It shows the influence of religion on the minds of victims, whereas the white supremacist believes in white supremacy and the religion of white supremacy. The way Cassius Clay was acting, I believe that there was a psychological reason for him tormenting Liston before the fight. But I think that in part, based upon page 175, the jealousy, you know, wanting to have something that someone else has, and Sonny Liston having the heavyweight championship at the time and all the perks that go along with it, I think that jealousy may have played a part in that. And then the anti-blackness, which we all battle with, I think it was easier for Cassius Clay to exploit Sonny Liston based upon his appearances, which was basically African features with his big nose and lips and his dark skin. And it seemed that no one in the United States thought that Clay could win. Even Elijah Muhammad, it was mentioned that on page 183, it seemed that the only people willing to go on record predicting a win by Clay were close family members and a smattering of associates of Malcolm X. So he was, Cash Clay was a heavy favorite to win. They even put in the odds. The odds went up with some of the antics that Cash Clay was pulling. I think it was 8-1 by the time of the fight. And why would you need to give the odds of the fight if there wasn't going to be a lot of betting on that? I think this reeks of mafia influence, but, you know, lack of proof and all that. I think that when I look at the fight again on YouTube, and it looks like that Cash is beating, you know, fair and square, but you can't trust these white people. And from the warning that the other NOI members gave to Cassius Clay, I think it was good advice, because later on he could tell that even Angelo Dundee was under suspicion and that there had been some type of tampering with some solutions on their gloves. But the author's rendition of the fight, I thought, was good, except for the racist references to animal-like moves of Clay slithering and placing knives like a bullfighter and busting the bump that showed up on Liston's face like the rind of a watermelon, and Liston snorting like a horse. And the one reporter that felt sorry for Liston in the end, you know, was wondering if he could feel sorry for a mastodon. You know, and that solution, Mosel, was a solution, a caustic solution that was used on fighters, and it's illegal now in boxing. But the Mosel can be blinding to if it gets into a fighter's eyes. So that may have been what was happening, but it just goes to show that even when you're fighting and earning money for these white people, they are using substances that could permanently disable you and leave you in a blinded state. So I'll mute my line there, give somebody else a chance. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Yes, sir. The caller at 4950, I heard you simultaneously. Were you going to comment?
Yes. I just wanted to say at the beginning when Mr. Ali was on the show, I found it odd that he called him, a pretty boy or a handsome boy. And then how they described the fight between him and Sonny Liston, the words that they were using to describe his knot on his face. They said that he, after Muhammad Ali won the fight, he bust out a jig. And then I'm into boxing, so I've watched the documentary before with Muhammad Ali and a few other fighters, and they talked about how people used to use tactics to fight dirty, and that was talked about. But they never said that it was for sure that that's what happened. And whenever, just like Mr. Denry Ford said, whenever you're participating in these type of sports for white people, they'll do anything to, you know, just to see two non-white people really hurt themselves. And if he knew that this was on his glove, they were supposed to stop the fight by law. Even when sparring, you have headgear on, but if someone feel like they don't want to continue to fight, they're supposed to just immediately stop the fight so that way no one gets hurt. And that's pretty much it. I'll mute my line.
Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if you all have commentary you want to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners. I am highly upset as a victim of white supremacy. It took me so long to get home this evening that I missed the vast majority of the reading. I'm finally made it home, so I have the book in hand, so I will be chiming in on the second half. But one thing I did want to speak about, and I love that Mr. Demery brought up the animalistic descriptions that they use, because I thought of the same thing, especially when he said the mastodon comment. I was like, oh, wow, perfect. But the other thing I thought about, too, is how we've discussed previously the importance of history and how white people like to recreate history and dates and time. And to me, that whole description of the fight as a crusade brings me back to the Moors being expelled from Europe January 2nd, 1492. And to me, this was their reenactment of that supposed to be, if Sonny Liston won, the reenactment of the Christians, i.e. white people, because essentially Mr. Liston actually was representing white supremacists being represented by the mafia and that entire criminal element. So I think in their minds, it was essentially a reenactment with two black pugilists of the expelling of the Moors from Europe in 1492. That's the only comment I have for now, but I can't wait for the second half. Thank you for taking my call.
For sure. Other listeners have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, and hello, callers and listeners. Yeah, very interesting reading once again.
Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please, ma'am.
Is my volume volume. Is that better?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you hear me a little bit better? Okay. Yeah, I was just, with the reading, when they were talking about that, like what they were using to kind of disable Muhammad Ali in the ring, and I just remember always seeing that in pictures, like in movies, they would show that if it was had boxing in it. Somebody was throwing acid in somebody's eye or whatever, but that's just very interesting how that really happened. I don't know why. I just thought it was just something for the movies, but that's interesting that they really did that, and it was one of the fights for Muhammad Ali. And, yeah, with some other stuff. It was a phrase that the author used. I think he used terrify logic or some phrase that he used in those authors. I guess I'm not disappointed with the authors because they're doing what they do, but they just, they're getting on my nerves, and that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Right. I think it might have been tortured logic. The phrase that you're talking about when he was talking about the suspicion that he had of other whites, that this was being encouraged by members of the Nation of Islam. This is in chapter 11, what we heard just today. We said, Angelo, according to Clay's tortured logic, was Italian, and Italian must be associated with the mafia, which certainly had a stake in Liston's keeping the title. I think that might have been the portion you're talking about.
Yeah, tortured logic. Wow. But yeah. Okay. Thank you, Gus.
For sure. Other folks that we have not heard from, do y'all have commentary you wanted to get in?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
I just want to say just real quick, I've kind of seen the fight, and I feel that the whatever solution was on Sonny Liston's glove, I fear that was the doing of a white supremacist, that whoever was in his corner, one of the mafia guys or his trainer or whoever. And that's all I wanted to say.
Right on. Anybody else that we missed have commentary they wanted to make sure they get in? Right on. I will assume that they might even be, 0613, last four digits, 0613. Do you have commentary you wanted to get in, sir, ma'am?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you for taking the call. Greetings to Gus and the callers and the listeners. What stood out to me when Clay was, I think they was doing the weigh-in, and he was, you know, going through his routine, and he went back to the dressing room, and then one guy stepped in, and he had a little heart situation, and he said, go to the back and, you know, try to calm him down and say, no, make him behave. I thought that was interesting. And then the author said, the attempt to domesticate Clay, I thought that was interesting too, referring to him like an animal. And I just wanted to say that I'm enjoying the reading. I think the relationship between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X really stood out in this first reading. It's unfortunate, you know, that their friendship couldn't go longer. And one more thing. I think Muhammad Ali, his ability to psych his opponent out with his the psychological part of it, I think that's brilliant. I think he was really excellent at that. It stood out in the reading today when they said in the midst of everything that was going on, he winked at, I think it was Sugar Ray Robinson. And thank you for taking the call, and I'm in my line.
Right on, right on. Let's see. Other folks that we have not heard from, anybody that we missed, you haven't been able to comment at all, you should be with us. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Peace to the callers, to the host, and to the platform. What stood out to me the most was the title of this chapter, which was called The Crusade. And, you know, the world that we live in today, along with some of the things that they were saying in the chapter, but especially the title of it, I found that to be significant. Like, hey, you know, I'll throw this in front of you now when it's two blacks or whatever, or non-whites, or, you know, going at it. But I don't really want you to take heed to this word when it got something to do with racism, white supremacy, or terrorism, and things like that. So, you know, right now, when we so concerned about jihad, it was good to read a chapter called Crusade. And that's all I wanted to say.
Right on, right on. Anyone else that we missed have comments they want to make sure they get in? All righty. Get a few comments, and then we should have time if other folks have any additional observations or questions they want to pose before we get to the second audio segment. I will say that for this portion of the audio that was dominated by this historic fight, I think probably one of the most significant, important fights in the history of boxing, if you know, however important that is within the context of white supremacy. I definitely think that this is a section that it would have been a much more enthralling read if a black narrator was reading this portion of the book, because you had so many of just the class. I think even people who don't watch boxing, I suspect a lot of people have seen the post-fight histrionics of Cassius Clay at the time, and you know, I'm the greatest, and you know, I'm pretty, I'm bad, and all that stuff. It would have been, in my view, it would have been a monumental improvement to have a black narrator during that section. But folks have, you know, said that that would have been the case for the entirety of the book, not just this section. I think it was just more glaring with such a significant moment being discussed. But be that as it may, some of the things that stood out to me when they compared it's kind of early on in the book when they compared the members of the Nation of Islam and Minister Malcolm X, compared them to the pod-like creatures from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I don't know if people have seen the older version of that, but comparing the members of the NOI to these creatures, beasts, if you will, that was in quotes, or actually I take that back. That section is not in quotes. I'm looking at it again right now. That section is not in quotes, and it's not footnoted. So I am not sure, because it seems, because he says at the beginning of the paragraph where he says all that, that a few white sports writers and journalists visited Clay's headquarters, and they made this observation, but he does not have anyone in quotes saying, or the authors, Mr. Roberts, Mr. Smith, they don't have anyone in quotes where they can attribute saying, you know, this person said that they looked like members in a pod. So either the authors perhaps practicing racism, white supremacy, or certainly whites at that time. Not that I think it's it is certainly believable that some racist suspects at the time would make that sort of comparison. But I do think that's significant, and just that way of thinking about these black males. It's always some way of demeaning black people who work against racism, white supremacy, where they are dehumanized. If you are in the Nation of Islam, you're in a cult, you're in a hate group, you're like some sort of alien creatures coming in here to brainwash people to get them to hate whites. It's the way it sounds to me, regardless of who it's attributed to. I thought it was important because this is right below that, where we've been talking, I think, frequently, almost the entire time that we've been doing this book, where they consistently say, the authors, Randy Roberts, Johnny Smith, where they consistently say that Muhammad Ali was deceptive. You know, he would not reveal his true self, and just keep using that word and words like that to describe Muhammad Ali. And we've been talking about how that is, in our view, an act of racism on the part of the authors. He does it here in this section, referring to Minister Malcolm X, where he says, but instead of telling the truth, where he's talking to Cassius Clay, and Clay had asked him how things were going with his standing in the Nation of Islam, and he says, but instead of telling the truth, Malcolm answered deceptively, nothing positive, and let it go at that. He said it cheerfully in a sort of no news is good news tone of voice, yet he knew that nothing positive translated to everything negative. Just in my view, if you're going to make that sort of analysis, and again, attaching it, he's being deceptive, he's a liar, he's deceptive, just like, you know, his blood brother Cassius Clay. These are just two deceptive Negroes who are just lying all the time. Just in my view, that analysis, that interpretation, most likely the author's practicing white supremacy again. Where, and I mean, there's so many, I'm glad you all picked out a lot of these metaphors. That's why I say that's very, very important to pay attention, even though a lot of these metaphors, they are in quotes, where they're attributing them to people who were writing at that time. But in my view, it is reinforcing that. And they're not taking time to call out that these metaphors are racist and are a part of a long tradition of dehumanizing black people and comparing black people to beasts, animals, that this is a long-running tradition under the system of white supremacy that continues right on through today. If folks remember last year when Serena Williams won the Athlete of the Year, and people were mad, and they were saying that the horse should have won it, that won the Triple Crown, and comparing her to this horse, and quite a few folks pointed that out, like, you know, this is, you know, astronomically, blatantly white supremacist to be arguing about it, comparing her to a horse and then saying that she shouldn't have won, that this horse should have won. But I mean, this is ongoing and this is all the time type thing. But they're not calling that out and saying that they're using these racist metaphors to describe these black athletes when they're talking or quoting these people. And I know that Randy Roberts, I know he's aware of this because he talked about this in the documentary on Jack Johnson, also a heavyweight championship fighter. And he talked about it explicitly, where they would do the exact same thing in talking about Jack Johnson, but where they have the passage here where they talk about Mr. Bundini, who was in Muhammad Ali's corner, one of his trainers, where he says the spaniel-eyed Bandini joined in for another chorus of "Float Like a Butterfly, Sting Like a Bee." And they had that's in quotes this time, spaniel-eyed. It's in quotes, spaniel is a type of dog. But again, why even include that? Why is it necessary to make sure that we reinforce the association of a black person with an animal of some sort? Moving forward. Next thing I picked out. Yeah, I think the exact same thing when you all pointed out the word domesticate, were these whites, Louisiana sponsorship group that are in control of Muhammad Ali at the time and, you know, trying to manage, control his career, where they are trying to get him to hush up and stop going through all these antics and clowning and what have you and promoting himself, domesticate, where I think, again, generally that term is used with animals. You domesticate a dog, you domesticate, you know, a cat or something that you want to be trained so that it's not wild, some beast that's just out in the wild. Again, the same pattern of how we think of and talk about black people, which reinforces that they should be mistreated because they are not humans. They are beasts who need a white person to control them. You all already got the passage as well with the language with Clay's tortured logic. Tortured logic, again, suggesting, implying that this is, you know, some nonsense about being suspicious of whites, that maybe the white managers, the white folks that are in Cassius Clay's corner, maybe they might be out to get him and that he should be suspicious of him. Just in my view, any white person writing, I would say anytime, even 2016, this would be an absurd act of white supremacy. But particularly if we're going to be talking about a time period 50 years ago, this is happening before the Freedom Summer, when Cheney and those two white boys were killed in Mississippi. This was still at a time when you had black people being killed left, right, with total impunity, when white people could go out and brutalize black people and it wouldn't even be given a thought. I think they already talked about the Birmingham church bombing, which was just months before this fight took place, and they didn't even convict anybody for that for decades. So for a black person to be suspicious of anyone is totally logical, and the authors should be able to acknowledge that. But of course they don't. Again, suspected act of racism, white supremacy. And particularly with the amount of corruption in the sport of boxing, just to stop that, they've already even acknowledged that there were all these conferences and hearings and investigations about all the crime in boxing and fixing of matches and gangsters controlling everything. Why would that be tortured logic? Why would that be unreasonable to think that, to have some suspicions about what could be happening with this fight? Again, just black people, anything in terms of black people thinking correctly, that we have enemies, whites, and that our thinking should reflect that, our thought, speech, action, and emotion should reflect that, has to be represented as crazy. This nigga's talking crazy. He's thinking crazy. His tortured logic. Next up. Even I hadn't even thought of that. This is not why I highlighted this passage, but even another metaphor, and this is not in quotes, so this is directly attributable to the authors when they get into describing the fight, where Cassius Clay's jabs angled off Sonny's left eye, then a right combination landed with tom-tom precision. That association with black people and drums, I think, not that there's anything wrong with drums and rhythm, but I do think that whites have routinely associated black people with drums in a pejorative and racist manner. There's also a long history about that, too. But the reason I highlighted this passage is continuing with the next sentence. Tex Mall of Sports Illustrated thought Cassius's work as methodically as a bullfighter placing banderillas. Welsing moment for sure. And again, I would say you're including all of these references to people who were writing 50 years ago. And even if you want to go with the standard racist argument, the tortured white supremacist logic, that, well, this is just representative of the time. And, you know, this was more standard to have these type of racist thoughts, racist tropes in writing at that time. Why would you include that now in a book that was written in 2016 and not point that out? That in and of itself is You are aligning yourself, you are supporting, encouraging, reinforcing these white supremacist notions in terms of how we think about black people, particularly comparing black people to these bulls. And that pops up over and over again, just within this section alone, comparing both of these black fighters in this one, Muhammad Ali, and then it's going to come up again later with Sonny Liston, but comparing them to bulls. I think Dr. Welsing talked about that consistently. Next up, let's see. The watermelon, yeah, you all pointed that out as well. Consistent aspect in the system of white supremacy. Let's see, next. Mastodon, for people who are not familiar, don't know what that means. Mastodon is a large, extinct, elephant-like mammal of the Miocene epochs, having teeth of a relatively primitive form and number. And they, in the sentence, they said, surveying Liston's face, which looked like a melon. There we go again. Melon that had fallen off the back of a truck. Murray thought it was possible to feel sorry for this mastodon. Even that sentence, the animal reference, once again, we talked about that, but possible. Not that we feel sorry for this nigger, this goon, this thug. And that's something, again, if you go back and do any research, where you'll hear whites, even like today, if they're commenting about Sonny Liston, just freely, unabashedly, this was a goon, this was a thug, this was some, you know, nigger that went out and brutalized people, some violent ruffian who went out and did all this gangster stuff. Even here, where he's been beaten and bloodied in his moment of defeat, even then, we don't really feel bad for him. Just, you know, another beaten nigra. That's about all it comes down to, which I think is pretty typical in the system of racism, white supremacy, that if Sonny Liston had won, they would have pretended that they like Sonny Liston and that he's great. You shut up that loudmouth nigra from the Louisville Lip. We were tired of hearing him. Anyway, they would have pretended that they really like Sonny Liston and that he was grand. He was their guy, but he didn't win. So, you know, oh, well, we'll just move along until Joe Frazier comes along or somebody who can beat Muhammad Ali, and then we'll root for them until we get tired of them, and then, you know, same deal. I did also, I thought it was, or it just reminded me when Mike Tyson, later on after he converted to Islam, when he fought Evander Holyfield the first time around, there was a lot of the same, well, I won't say a lot, but I did hear even Evander Holyfield kind of use the same language. I don't think it was presented as a crusade, but it certainly was presented as a Christianity versus Islam thing when they fought the first time around. And if someone called me on it, I think I could even put my hand on some of the articles or quotes, because I definitely remember Evander Holyfield saying the same thing when they fought the first time around in the 90s, that this was, as I said, Christianity versus Islam. Other than that, I think I'd be willing to pause there if other folks had any comments or questions that they wanted to ask. I too noted in the Jack Parr interview, and I didn't play the whole thing. The whole thing is available online if you want to check it out. That was leading up, part of the lead up to this fight, where the host Jack Parr, racist suspect, where he says this is a nice boy, or however you phrase it, but he calls him a boy. Cassius Clay was 22, I believe, at the time, had already won an Olympic gold medal and was about to be inducted, about to be drafted to Vietnam, but still referenced as a boy on a national television audience. Other folks have anything that stood out, anything that they wanted to make sure that they commented on? Oh, I also wanted to make sure I got in as well. The major theme for this book has been, in my view, surveillance, FBI, in addition to the authors and the way that these whites have written this book. And I think a lot of our view, practicing racism, but for me, the surveillance that these individuals were under, I think this might be one of the few chapters where there were really no references to FBI reports or FBI surveillance. It was pretty minimal in this chapter, I think, because so much of it was just focused on the fight and what was happening in the ring. I am sure that there were, you know, agents, whether they were informants or directly employed by the FBI, I'm sure they were in attendance for this fight. Certainly, if Minister Malcolm was there, or any other members of the Nation of Islam, I am sure that they were in attendance as well. But this is one of the few times in the chapter where there has not been a lot of sources from FBI files and what the racist surveillance program notes that they were taking on these two prominent individuals. Anything else pop up that folks thought was significant from this portion of the read?
Gus, I wanted to ask you.
Go ahead, Ross.
Oh, okay, thank you. I wanted to ask you if earlier in the reading, if they alluded again to the fact that Malcolm was hiding behind Cassius Clay, as if he's trying to use him as a buffer to I guess, extend his life or to save his life in some fashion. Did they do that again?
Briefly, that did come up. I think they had a section where they talked about that was kind of Minister Malcolm's plan, that if Cassius Clay won, then this would be, he did have a pretty prominent section. I can find it for you if you give me a second. But they had a prominent section where he talked about if Cassius Clay won, which Malcolm X, one of the few people on the planet, according to what they say at the beginning, once he wins, that this will be such a big deal for the Nation of Islam to be able to have Muhammad Ali in, or Cassius Clay at the time, to be able to have him in Muhammad Speaks, the NOI newsletter, and to be able to have this black male as heavyweight champion and what that would do for black males specifically, for black masculinity specifically in this area of the world, and that this would be a whole new era for the Nation of Islam once Cassius Clay wins this fight and becomes heavyweight champion, and that he could deliver Cassius Clay to Elijah Muhammad, and the only cost would be if he could be fully reinstated. And then he goes on right after that to say that, you know, the Nation of Islam had already moved on, and they were just, they didn't think Cassius Clay was going to win. And if he did some way stumble into a victory, then they would just, you know, do all of that without incorporating Malcolm X into the equation. But he did bring up a pretty, I won't say it's too lengthy because most of this chapter was focused on Muhammad Ali in the fight, but he did have like a page where he kind of laid out what I just said.
Okay, because I'm thinking I can't wait to get him on the show because that to me is such a profound act of white supremacy. The reason why is because they're giving no proof. Like, where are they getting this from? And I'm pretty sure if that was Malcolm's intention, this would have come out a long time ago. There's been many books written about Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X's relationship. Like I said, I've heard Dr. Bennett and Dr. Clark both speak about Malcolm, the path that Malcolm used, this is from people who knew him personally, was a path of trying to ingratiate himself to Elijah Muhammad in order to get back into the nation, because that was his ultimate goal. But no one ever said that I've ever come across, ever alluded to some sort of unscrupulous, cowardly method of him going about doing so. So I can't wait to get them on the show just to ask them, like, where are they getting this information from that's not in quotes? So it's not like they heard it firsthand from someone. This is a racist assumption, in my opinion. And on the other thing I thought about, too, was just listening to the discussion on mescaline and the actual fight itself. It kind of just brings me back to white people, because white people invented dogfighting, and I know what some of the things they do in dogfighting is they'll rub, you know, the dogs down with milk and cayenne pepper and other things, so that if a dog was to bite them, or to, like, let's say their face rubbed on the animal's sides or something, the same thing would happen where they would be discouraged from continuing to fight because of their eyes burning, things like that. And then, of course, being of Trinidadian descent, a big thing there is cockfighting all over the Caribbean and South America. And that's something else that originally it started in the Indus Valley about 6,000 years ago, is the earliest known references to cockfighting. But when white people took over cockfighting, they started to employ, because gamecocks actually have a big spur on the back of their leg that they use in defense in fighting males off to get them out of their territory. That's the whole origin of that aggression that they have, is essentially they have like a harem of females, and anytime a male comes into their territory, they basically will attack that male to get rid of them, or to kill, they'll fight to the death. Now, when white people took over cockfighting, that spur, they actually filed it down, cut it, and then filed it down. And then what they did was they fitted an even longer, sharper, more deadly metal spike. And that's what cockfighting had developed in once white people took over that process. It became more violent and more bloody. And if you look at pugilism, boxing, you'll see that
our ancestors have been treated the same way. So the same way they treat gamecocks, the same way they treat pit bulls and every other type of animal that they fight, they were treating Muhammad Ali and all the other boxers that we can think of in the same manner. So when some people disagree with cockfighting or with boxing, and they discuss the fact that it's rooted in white supremacy, to me, that history, because we're viewed as animals, kind of brings you to that realization that that's all we were to them, was just basically something they could use. Even if you look at Jack Johnson and the origins of Jack Johnson starting off in fighting other young black males in these groups until, you know, some of them getting beaten to death or being maimed in the process just to get a little bit of money to take home to their family so they could try and, you know, eat, get something to eat for that evening or for that week, however much money they made to carry them through. This is all like the legacy of these things that white people were doing prior to that is expressing itself between human beings. So it's just something that I thought about when the whole discussion came up about mescaline and how it worked and the fact that people did use it unscrupulously to potentially damage other fighters. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to get a couple of things in. One thing was when the FBI had the phones tapped and they were monitoring the movements of Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, and Elijah Muhammad, and then they made a reference to Malcolm X calling back to Chicago, and they took that information from the FBI documents. They didn't know exactly who he talked to when he called Chicago, but then they said Chicago is Elijah Muhammad. You know, and I just thought that was strange, because when you're monitoring someone's day-to-day activities and you listening in to phone calls, you know exactly who the person called if they call to Chicago. They're saying Liston wasn't a popular champion, and that Clay Yin for the black Muslim white-hating sect of fanatics was revealed, neither Cassius was a popular challenger. So it's this hate for the NOI that was motivating, you know, a lot of this anti-blackness and the, you know, talking about Clay and also Liston. But I'll mute my line on that. That's all. I wanted to say something else. I can't find it. Numerology of, I didn't know that the NOI was into numerology when Malcolm X was talking about seat number 7 and row 7 and adding all these numbers up in February. And it was a few days following the Savior's Day. I just thought maybe he was drifting back to a little of his earlier days when he was a numbers runner. But I mute my line on that. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure. Just to Roz's point about the references where they talk, the authors, where they talk about this alleged plan that Minister Malcolm had to get reinstated, and he's going to use Cassius Clay to do this. They have one footnote on this passage where I said all it would cost is Malcolm's full reinstatement. They have one footnote for that, and it's referencing the death and life of Malcolm X, which is written by a white author, Peter Goldman. They also reference Carl Evans' The Judas Factor and Redemption Song. Manning Marble. His book on Malcolm X and Redemption Song. So they have four different books that are referenced for this portion of the text. They have the page numbers as well. I don't have all four of them in front of me, although I have read two of those. But I have to go back to dig to see if they also make that same point, that if they also have concluded that Cassius Clay was going to be Malcolm's ticket to being, you know, getting back in good graces with Elijah Muhammad. But I have to check those. The Life and Death of Malcolm X, as well as The Judas Factor by Carl Evans. I had to check both of those out again to see if either of those authors postulate the same theory.
Hey, Gus, I want to look into that, too, because I have two books, two of those books as well. I have the Manning Marables book, and I have Carl Evans's book as well, because I read that book, and I don't remember him alluding to anything of that type in that book. I could be wrong. Once I look up the footnotes and check the page numbers, I'll confirm that, but I don't remember him ever alluding to anything like that at all. So I would love to investigate that. And if you can let me know the book that you have, because you have a book that I don't have. You have two as well, but one of the books that you have, I don't have. So if you confirm that in the book that you have, let me know too. Well, let us know, I should say. Thank you.
For sure. Other folks, any comments they want to get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Try to be heard.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all. Thomas Smith in New York. Had a few observations. I like to start with the interview at the beginning. The man was definitely, in my opinion, practicing racism. He called him a pretty boy in a very, pedophilic tone. If you ask me, yeah, you are a pretty boy. And, that goes to show to me the homoerotic and the heteroerotic white behavior. Also started this reading this week with, it was snowing in Florida, and also foxes in Florida, which was shocking to me. I didn't even know that would happen. So, interesting. When he was doing the writing about the NOI members, looking mean, wearing ties, not talking to white people. Was that the author's thoughts, or was it quoted or referenced, Gus?
Which portion again?
It was a portion where I believe it was like Ali was living in a White House, and they were cooking beans and greens, and the reporter or the white guy observed that he was there with the black Muslims, and they were there, and they stood out because they didn't have any emotions. They didn't talk to white people.
I think that's in the portion where I said they compared them to being like the invasion of the body snatchers. That portion is not in quotes. I have to look to find specifically where he says, where they say that they were looking mean. The portion I'm looking at right now, where it's talking about the members of the Nation of Islam. Well, go ahead.
I probably should take that back. I'm not sure he said looking mean. I just kind of wrote that in there, but I know for sure this part, he was describing their outfits, describing their bow ties, their white shirts,
right.
And he said that they would not talk to white people.
Right. That's the exact paragraph where they're being compared to the invasion of the body snatchers. Nothing is in quotes in that paragraph where it says a few white sports writers and journalists visited Clay in his Fifth Street quarters. They wrote about the chaos, the cast of characters that included jesters, clowns, trainers, hangers-on, and somber, angry-eyed, intimidating men in dark suits, white shirts, and bow ties who watched the action around them and hardly had a good word to say to any white man. Other members of Clay's camp referred to them as the Brotherhood, but they looked to the white reporters like a sect of pod people. They dressed alike, acted alike, talked alike, and seemed to think alike. Nothing in that paragraph is in quotes except for when members of Clay's camp refer to them as brotherhood. That's the only, and it's only the Brotherhood, that's the only portion that's in quotes. Everything else is all the authors, and there's no footnote as well.
Yeah, I had that thought, and I'm glad you just pointed that out, because as I'm reading it, I'm like, man, who wrote that? What reporter wrote that? I'm really curious. So, yeah, I definitely think that was an act of racism on behalf of the author. Or the authors. And lastly, the orator, the white orator that's reading the book, he's trying to mimic Ali's voice. I really hate when white people do that. It sort of reminds me of, you could see a plain white female and she gets around black women, and all of a sudden, hey, girlfriend, like the whole jargon and the lady. So, yeah, put like a soda glass, thing like a bean, I just really hate when white people do that. And I'll make my life. Thank you.
For sure. Any other last comment before we get to the our second audio segment? Anything else folks want to make sure they get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Hello, I want to get one last comment in. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I think that the racist white supremacists, you know, they want to turn us and everybody else into the monsters that they are. Because I'm thinking about it, and, you know, I've been listening to the context for a while. And just really thinking about it, I think they kind of want to turn us into the monsters they are. Think about boxing. Now, boxing, okay, it's a sport, okay, so they say. I can see you doing something like that if you're training for combat. Maybe you'll possibly have to, your men will have to go into war, and it might come down to hand-to-hand combat, so we need to stay fit, and, you know, so we do these practices, you know, for a couple hours a day. But they've turned it into something disgusting and horrible where you get up there in a ring in front of thousands of people and get there and just beat each other down, bloody, there's blood everywhere. People are doing medicine in your eye. You might die. We heard about people's brain stems getting busted from behind to front or whatever. And it's horrible, and it's horrible. And I want to put that out there. Thank you.
Right on. We will go ahead and get to the second audio segment. If you have anything that you did not get to share, just jot a note. We should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. Shouldn't wait until the last minute to get your hand. If you did not comment at all, you'll be the first person to speak once the second audio segment finishes up. But we're starting. We are on chapter 12, Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Cassius Clay. Chapter 12 is Free to Be Me. This is the context of audio, context of white supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Chapter 12, Free to Be Me. The power of the white world is threatened whenever a black man refuses to accept the white world's definitions. James Baldwin. Now everyone wanted him, not Sonny Liston. Before the match, experts and casual fans alike thought Cassius would go directly from the fight to the hospital, and that Sonny would head to his own victory celebration. But Sonny got the ride to St. Francis, and Cassius, resplendent in a black tuxedo, disappeared. Outside his dressing room, Dee Dee Sharp waited patiently with her mother. After recording Slow Twistin' with Chubby Checker, and releasing such hit singles as Mashed Potato Time and Do the Bird, the attractive and coquettish Sharp was at the top of her recording career. During the previous few months, she had seen Cassius off and on as their schedules permitted, but their relationship had not yet bloomed into a full-scale romance. She was just one of the foxes that seemed to form the wallpaper of his life. George Plimpton suspected Cassius's use of the word foxes was half affectionate and half suspicious. He feels that girls can be sly and sneaky and are to be watched warily. Dee Dee saw herself as more than just another fox, and she had plans to spend the evening with the new heavyweight champion of the world. So she waited, crammed among other well-wishers who claimed they knew all along that Cassius would win, and every once in a while she would call out to someone squeezing in or out of the dressing room, "Tell Cassius that Dee—" She called him Cassius around the men, but in private she used his middle name, Marcellus. "A beautiful name. I can say it over and over," she told Plimpton. Perhaps Dee Dee thought she would go to the Fontainebleau Hotel with Cassius. Sam Cooke, friends with both Cassius and Dee Dee, was staying there, although it took a virtual sit-in by his manager for the front desk to find him a suite. Several of the members of the Louisville sponsoring group had even talked about a victory celebration for Cassius at the most luxurious hotel in Miami Beach. Champagne, showgirls, cakes. The celebration would be first class. The scenario, Dee Dee Sharp on his arm and champagne at a luxury hotel, conjures images of heavyweight championship style. Jack Dempsey and Estelle Taylor, Joe Louis and Marva Trotter, and from baseball, Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. That was the way it was supposed to be. By fighting blind in the fifth round and battering Sonny Liston in the sixth, Cassius Clay had earned the title of champion and his share of the good life. While Dee Dee waited, Cassius was in his dressing room, holding court. He had told the reporters that he was going to win, told them loudly and often. Now that he had their full attention, he gave them another chance. After castigating them for their lack of faith, he demanded, "Who's the greatest?" A few browbeaten scribes surrendered and said, "You are." Only then did the new champion smile. It was after midnight when he came out of his dressing room. Accompanied by his brother and a few friends from the nation, he pushed through the mob of photographers and newspapermen. Standing on her toes, Dee Dee waved, calling out, "Marcellus! Marcellus!" She didn't even receive a glance as he swept past her. From the arena, he headed north toward the Hampton House and a small private celebration with Malcolm X and a few other friends, including Rudy, Howard Bingham, Sam Cooke, and Archie Robinson. A joyous crowd had packed the Hampton House's luncheonette by the time Clay's party arrived. Cassius and Rudy, the two victorious boxers, sat in places of honor on the center stools at the lunch counter, surrounded by loud, talking, joking black men who had attended the fight or turned up to shake hands with the new heavyweight champion. Cassius's victory dinner was a large bowl of ice cream, which he wolfed down in a matter of seconds. While Cassius ate, Malcolm and Howard Bingham snapped photographs, Malcolm whispering in Cassius's ear, his hand resting on the champ's shoulder, Malcolm bursting with laughter while Cassius teased him, Malcolm and Cassius exchanging knowing glances. It was the happiest moment they had ever shared together. The two appeared inseparable. Malcolm seemed to take as much satisfaction from Clay's triumph and Hampton House victory party as the fighter himself. In his mind, after all, Cassius's victory was his as well. Associates had remarked that they seemed as close as brothers. During the raucous stage of the evening, he called writer Alex Haley, with whom he had become close during their collaboration on Malcolm's autobiography. "Clay was like Malcolm's little brother," Haley recalled. Malcolm was very, very proud of him. During the phone call, over the loud voices in the background, Malcolm was boasting how his little brother had done marvelously well. Showing more excitement than he had displayed at the match, he called to Cassius to holler something to Haley, which he did. It was as if the big brother called the shots, and the little brother amiably went along. After a short public celebration, the inner group moved to Malcolm's bedroom for more serious conversation. The bubbly, playful banter was left behind at the lunch counter, replaced by a more somber mood. Now that Cassius was champion, Malcolm had urgent matters to discuss. He thought it was time for his friend to play a more active role in his plans. Cassius, Malcolm, and Jim Brown, the National Football League's premier running back, began talking about the future of the black man. Sympathetic to many of the Nation of Islam's goals, Brown was as respected by race men as he was by professional football players. He did not believe in heroes, but he admired Malcolm's confrontational mentality. Like the combative minister, the outspoken football star insisted that blacks must demand their rights, fight for them, and defend them at all costs. Distrustful of white men, Brown questioned passive resistance and nonviolence. "I am skeptical of white men," he would later write in his autobiography, "because even the best of them want me to be patient, to follow Martin Luther King's advice and turn the other cheek until God knows when." Listening to Brown, Malcolm could tell that he was sincere in his beliefs. Malcolm clearly shared his view that famous black athletes had a responsibility to join the freedom movement. For Cassius, then, the heavyweight title was a prelude to more important accomplishments, ones that transcended sports and crossed over to politics. "Well, Brown," Malcolm asked the football player, "don't you think it's time for this young man to stop spouting off and get serious?" Brown agreed. The title was not an end in itself. It was a platform from which to advance far more urgent matters. The plan called for Cassius to use the title for his purposes, not to be used and consumed by it. Cassius also understood that his victory over Liston marked the beginning of a new stage in his life. There was nothing left to conquer in the world of boxing. His athletic achievements now matched his worldwide fame. His actions had vindicated his boasts, certifying his incessant claims that he was the greatest. Listening to Malcolm's plans, Cassius didn't brag or rhyme. He paid attention, and as far as Malcolm could tell, agreed. Malcolm said that they talked for several hours, which is doubtful, given the timeline of the evening, but they did converse long enough to hit the points that were important to both of them. Finally, exhausted from a day that had included a wild weigh-in, action-filled title fight, post-fight ring antics, and several press conferences, Cassius said he needed a nap. Stretching out on Malcolm's bed, he went to sleep. But he didn't sleep long. While Malcolm was somewhere else, Cassius awoke and had a meaningful tête-à-tête with Jim Brown. They talked about race in America, the politics of the Nation of Islam, and the feud between Malcolm and Elijah. As he listened, it was clear to Brown that there was a serious disconnect between Malcolm's plans and Cassius's. He recalled that Clay had already made up his mind. He could no longer follow Malcolm. The messenger would not allow it. Elijah was a little man, Clay told Brown, but extremely powerful, and had always supported him. Cassius loved Malcolm, but from that day on, he would never again be his friend. Had Clay made that choice by the early morning hours of February 26th? When he ate vanilla ice cream and Malcolm whispered in his ear, had he made the hard political decision that would inevitably alter both men's lives? Was it possible for Jim Brown and Malcolm X to have such different interpretations of Clay's intentions that morning? Given Cassius's avoidance of personal disagreement, and his reluctance to say anything in a one-on-one personal exchange that would disappoint a friend, he might have allowed Malcolm to hear and believe what the minister desperately wanted to hear and believe. Or he may have told both Brown and Malcolm versions of the truth and kept the full truth to himself. Houston Horn of Sports Illustrated reported on some of the post-fight events, though he knew nothing about Clay's conversations with Malcolm and Brown. But the thought that Malcolm was even there led to a sagacious conclusion. From Cassius's activities at the Hampton House, two things were certain, Horn wrote. His tastes are just as simple, and his thoughts on life just as murky, as they have been for years. Sometime shortly after 2 a.m., while Cassius was nodding half asleep in bed, someone informed him that a score of neighbors were waiting in his yard for him to return to his bungalow. "They are the people I mean something to," he said, before dressing and departing the Hampton House. Once back at his house, he spent 15 minutes or so shaking hands and signing autographs before announcing that he was calling it a night. He had another press conference in the morning and wanted to get at least a few hours of sleep. If Cassius had gotten to sleep, a doubtful proposition, he hadn't been in that state for long when a loud knock at the door disturbed everyone in the champ's bungalow. Three Los Angeles reporters, Brad Pye and Doc Young of the Los Angeles Sentinel, and Jim Murray of the Los Angeles Times, just happened to be driving up in Colored Town and by chance saw a single bulb glowing through a frosted glass window. All three knew Clay, and they seemed blissfully unconcerned about the propriety of the visit. Stretched out on a couch, wearing only white undershorts and gray socks, Cassius politely ignored the time and the intrusion and said, "Come in." This was no scene out of a Hollywood boxing movie, thought Murray. In The Champion, the Kirk Douglas character wins the title and immediately moves uptown, the best booze, broads, and clothes that money could buy. In Cassius's low-rent dwelling, however, there were no crowds in mink and cigar smoke, no clink of glasses, no loud music, and louder sycophantry. There was just the exhausted boxer and a small circle of half-asleep friends. Tired, occasionally rubbing his stomach, Cassius began to talk, slowly, like a man on his first visit to a psychiatrist. He talked about Sonny. "I just played with him, is all. About Angelo, pushing him out of the corner for the fifth round. This is for the heavyweight championship of the world. Get out there and fight. But mostly about God and his own providential journey to the title. I'm not around rich people. I'm the champ now, and God wants me to be champ. God, he believed, had a plan for him. At 3:30, Archie Robinson arrived, looking angry that a white reporter, Murray, was taking up Cassius's time. "What's this, a press conference at 3:30 in the morning?" he said, without checking his watch. "I'm the boss here," Clay said, in a near whisper. "Oh, I know," Robinson responded. But the reporters departed nonetheless. "That man sure puts a pall on a place when he comes in to see Cassius, doesn't he?" Pye said. "For a fact," Young answered. Around Malcolm X, Cassius bubbled with life, a mixture of pleasure and mischief. But Archie Robinson prompted a wholly different vibe. It was like the invasion of the body snatchers. Cassius seemed like one of them. One of the pod people. The result of the Clay-Liston match shocked reporters. Some even mused in their columns about the possibility that the fight might have been fixed. But the history of boxing is full of upsets, and Clay's victory over Liston was no more improbable or unexpected than James J. Braddock's 1935 defeat of Max Baer. What was more startling than the result, however, was the traditional day-after press conference with the champion. During Joe Louis's reign, such events had been relaxed affairs. Joe would show up at Mike Jacobs's Madison Square Garden office, take a seat in the large red leather chair, leaf through the morning's funny pages, eat an apple, and field reporters' questions. Joe never really said much, but he managed to give the sports writers at least a germ of a story. As often as he tried to explain what it was like to be the most feared fighter in the world, he could never exactly convey how it felt to be Joe Louis. There was nothing informal or cozy about Clay's late-morning press conference on February 26th. Less than 12 hours before, just after defeating Liston, Cassius had enough energy left to take on the press, excoriating them repeatedly in a rude, arrogant speech for backing the wrong fighter. In several mean, bitter tirades, he told the writers that they should hang their heads in shame, repent for their literary transgressions, and beg him for forgiveness. "You hypocrites," he had shouted. "What are you going to say now?" Clay's words prompted reporter Jack Kofed to respond, "He probably never will become a great fighter, because a man with his ridiculous egoism isn't likely to learn. This man is neither a credit to the game he plays, nor his race." His race. It was that, even more than his words, that lent a cutting edge to the conference. That morning, in an article about Malcolm X and the black Muslims, Mike Handler had reported in the New York Times that Clay was a Muslim and a close friend of Malcolm. Printed in the journalistically conservative Times, a paper that prohibited its reporters from editorializing in their articles, the statement carried added weight. Although it was widely known that Cassius was sympathetic with the Nation of Islam, he had not yet admitted publicly that he had formally joined the organization. He arrived at the Veterans Room at the Convention Center, punctually at 11 a.m., looking and acting as if he were applying for admission to Princeton University. Dressed in a tweed jacket with leather elbow patches and a white button-down Oxford shirt, he answered questions in a singularly non-Cassius Clay manner. Instead of displaying his usual 150-watt eyes and P.T. Barnum mouth, he began talking in a quiet voice, his eyes focused on his feet, speaking barely above the sound a soft wind makes, rustling through the leaves of a tree. "Speak louder, Cassius. We can't hear you," several reporters called out. In the past, no one had to give that sort of urging, Arthur Daly wrote in his column. Clay's personality pivot shocked him. This was the day for the fighter to crow and preen, to tell the world once again that he was the greatest. Instead, Clay wore a discernible cloak of humility, eschewing the sound and fury of the day before, and now speaking with a quiet modesty. "I'm through talking," he began. "All I have to be is a nice, clean gentleman. I've proved my point. Now I'm going to set an example for all the nice boys and girls. I'm through talking." It was as if the Louisville Lip had died or had never existed at all. It had just been a role Clay played, a part he created and mastered, but it was not who he was. He did it to breathe life into his sport and to promote his career. "My mouth overshadowed my ability," he admitted. He confessed that he did not even enjoy boxing. "I only fight to make a living, and when I have enough money, I won't fight anymore. I don't like to fight. I don't like to get hurt. I don't like to hurt anybody." All he wanted was to be champion for the people, especially the dispossessed, the poor folk and the drunks and the bums. "I just want to make people happy." The reporters had heard variations of Clay's statements before. The desire to do good, make a difference, get out of the brutal sport before it robbed him of his senses. They were promises other fighters had made and failed to keep. For a while, Cassius discussed the odd twists and turns of the match. He admitted he had wanted to quit before the fifth round and actually felt sorry for Liston. "You people put too much load on him. You built him up too big, and now he has such a long way to fall." As he talked, the older riders nodded their heads and smiled in agreement. "If he sticks to this pose, he can win a vast amount of popularity," Daly wrote. Soon, most of the sports writers had what they needed and departed the room to attend Liston's press conference or to file their stories. The bombast and poetry was all an act, they would write. And the real Cassius Clay was a clean-living, thoughtful young man whose only harm was playing a role too well. When the room was less than half full, a younger reporter asked an essentially forbidden question. "Are you a card-carrying member of the Black Muslims?" For a moment, Clay looked shocked, then angry. The unwritten code of the sports world ruled some questions out of bounds. Unless the athlete raised the subject, reporters did not ask questions about politics, religion, drinking, or marital infidelities. Now someone was asking Clay if he belonged to what most white Americans and some black Americans believed was an extreme religious cult. Immediately, Clay's countenance shifted from quietly respectful to pugnaciously defiant. "Card-carrying, what does that mean?" he challenged. It sounded like he was being accused of belonging to the Communist Party. Then, without directly answering the question, he defended the Nation of Islam and addressed the expectations of white Americans. "I believe in Allah and in peace. I don't try to move into white neighborhoods. I don't want to marry a white woman. I was baptized when I was 12, but I didn't know what I was doing. I'm not a Christian anymore. As for the nation, I go to a black Muslim meeting, and what do I see? I see that there's no smoking and no drinking, and their women wear dresses down to the floor. And then I come out on the street, and you tell me I shouldn't go there. Well, there must be something in there if you don't want me to go there." Robert Lipsight's New York Times report captured the moment when the worlds of sport and politics collided. There was a trace of antagonism when Clay refused to play the mild and socially uninvolved sports hero stereotype and began to use the news conference as a platform for socio-political theory. That was exactly what Cassius and Malcolm had discussed, using the title as a venue to address political issues, not as an accomplishment to curry favor with white America. Floyd Patterson made liberal Americans optimistic about the future when he spoke quietly of the need for peace, cooperation, and integration. He played by the existing rules of the sports world, presenting himself as an acceptable role model for black and white youths. Clay refused to play that part in the heavyweight morality play. "In the jungle, lions are with lions and tigers are with tigers, and redbirds stay with redbirds, and bluebirds with bluebirds," he said. "That's human nature, too, to be with your own kind. I don't want to go where I'm not wanted." Cobbled from the teaching of Elijah Muhammad and rhetoric of Malcolm X, Cassius had made variations of this speech before, but never as the heavyweight champion, a position of some authority. Taking advantage of the moment, he spoke his mind freely and boldly. He defended Malcolm. "If he's so bad, why don't they put him in jail?" He addressed his support for Malcolm's teachings. I catch so much hell. Why? Why me when I don't try to bust into schools or march around or throw bricks? Clay's rambling defense of the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X was an example of his main point, one that Lipsyte used in his lead the next day. Glancing at the group of mostly white reporters, some angry, others shocked, a few supportive, Clay asserted, I don't have to be what you want me to be. I'm free to be who I want. It was a revolutionary statement, announcing his emancipation from the prescribed role for Negro athletes. In a shockingly radical declaration that amounted to a manifesto, he said he was neither a Negro, a Christian, nor an advocate of racial integration. He was black, a Muslim, and a separatist. Shortly after the press conference ended, Rudy Clay and Sam Saxon arrived together at the Chicago Coliseum for the Savior's Day convention. About 2:30, the celebration began with Louis X., Malcolm's replacement as Master of Ceremonies, introducing a procession of speakers honoring Elijah Muhammad. Rudy was not an impressive orator, nor was he considered an important figure in the nation, but on this day, the day after his brother became heavyweight champion of the world, he found himself center stage, standing at the podium just a few feet away from Elijah. Cassius sends the greetings of Assalamu Alaikum to all his brothers and sisters at Savior's Day, Rudy announced. He said he'd like to thank each and every one of you for the prayers they have said for his success in winning the heavyweight title. Rudy's speech was part of Elijah Muhammad's carefully orchestrated plan. Placing Clay's brother on the dais, surrounded by the nation's officials, conveyed a clear message. Malcolm believed that he and Cassius shared a brotherhood, but Elijah intended to make Cassius and Rudy feel like they were part of the royal family. Muhammad reminded the 5,000 followers in attendance, I have been given the keys to your salvation, and I can send you to either heaven or hell. When he announced that Cassius belonged to the Nation of Islam, the crowd roared with cheers and applause. Elijah beamed with pride. I'm so glad that Cassius Clay admits he is a Muslim. Before the fight, Muhammad had made no public announcement supporting Cassius. He had believed what most boxing experts believed. Liston would not only defeat Clay, he would pummel him. No one from Muhammad Speaks was sent to Miami to cover the fight. The last thing Elijah wanted was for the nation to be disgraced by a follower laid out on his back. When Malcolm first asked Muhammad for permission to attend the fight in Miami, the messenger answered, Yes, but if you do go, it will be as a private person. You will not in any way be representing us, because it's impossible for Cassius Clay to win. The day after Clay won, Muhammad confessed something that no one had heard from him before. The deaf, dumb, and blind wanted Cassius to get his face torn up, but Allah and myself said, No. Then he delivered a message meant for Malcolm. Clay had confidence in Allah and in me as his only messenger. His faith in Allah and his inspiration from Muhammad, not Malcolm, assured his victory and left him unscarred. Around 8 o'clock the next morning, Malcolm met Cassius for breakfast at the Hampton House, where they read Muhammad's announcement in the papers. Cassius had become a pawn in a power struggle between Malcolm and Elijah, and the Supreme Minister had just made a bold move. Now it was Malcolm's turn. He realized that he had to do something to lure Cassius. He had to offer him something that Muhammad could not. Time, Malcolm realized, was running out. Elijah would not wait much longer before he made another move. At that moment, Robert Lipsyte observed, Malcolm understood that he had not really, totally reached Clay. When he finished reading Muhammad's statement, he folded the paper and tossed it onto the counter, knowing that he had to keep one eye on Cassius and the other on Elijah. Seeing Cassius talk with Malcolm made reporters ask the new champion if Muhammad's statement about his membership in the nation was accurate. That is true, and I am proud of it, he answered. But what's all the commotion about? The commotion was all about the country's fears. Fears of a religion most Americans knew little about. Fears that the Muslims were a black menace, lurking in the shadows. Fears that Elijah Muhammad intended to lead a violent uprising. And fears that Cassius Clay was the bogeyman in the closet. Sports writers wanted to know why he had joined the black Muslims. "You call it black Muslims, I don't," he asserted. "This is a name that has been given to us by the press, yet people brand us as a hate group. They say we want to take over the country. They say we're communists." None of it was true. The Muslims, he said, didn't carry knives or guns. They were peaceful people who avoided confrontation. He joined the nation because the Muslims offered a sanctuary, a utopia, free from racial violence. "I want peace, and I do not find peace in an integrated world," he explained. "I don't want to be blown up. I don't want to be washed down sewers. I just want to be with my own kind." A childhood friend later explained to Jack Olson that when Cassius talked about race, when he says, "I don't want to be bombed, I don't want to be set on fire, I don't want to be lynched or have no dogs chase me," he's expressing a general fright more than a real racial attitude. Cassius finds it safer to be with Negroes, his own kind. It allays his fear of all those things his father used to tell him the whites would do to him. He keeps this tight little Negro group around him, and he's scared to death to venture away from it. Clay maintained that it was only natural for blacks to live among blacks and for whites to live among whites. Sounding like Malcolm's assistant minister, he said, "We believe that forced and token integration is but a temporary and not an everlasting solution to the Negro problem. It is merely a pacifier. We don't think one people should force its culture upon another." Malcolm grinned as he listened to his pupil deliver one of his favorite lines. "A rooster crows only when it sees the light. Put him in the dark and he'll never crow. I have seen the light, and I'm crowing." As he listened to Clay's answers, he heard his voice grow stronger, bolder, and more defiant. There was no other athlete in America who so audaciously challenged the politics of the sports world. "Clay is the finest Negro athlete I have ever known," Malcolm asserted. "The man who will mean more to his people than any athlete before him. He is more than Jackie Robinson was, because Robinson is the white man's hero. But Cassius is the black man's hero. Do you know why? Because the white press wanted him to lose. They wanted him to lose because he is a Muslim. You notice nobody cares about the religion of other athletes, but their prejudice against Clay blinded them to his ability." White men were not the only ones blinded by Cassius. In their private moments together, between the minister's lectures and lessons, during their conversations and laughter, Malcolm came to believe in their friendship, their brotherhood, their bond. He rarely trusted any man, and few ever visited his home for family dinners the way that Cassius did. Malcolm fell for Clay's boyish wonder, his innocence and charm. Never did he imagine that Clay would hurt him. He trusted his own eyes, seeing only what he wanted to see, a magnetic young black man full of conviction and sincerity. But Malcolm failed to apply the key lesson from his relationship with Elijah Muhammad. Things were not always what they seemed. Later that day, Malcolm and Cassius made plans to see each other again soon. They shook hands, Malcolm congratulated him once more, and then he departed for the airport. As he waited for his flight to New York, Malcolm probably thought about Clay and how their friendship had evolved. He'd never felt closer to him than he had during the days between his suspension and Clay's title celebration. They had known each other for only a little more than a year and a half, but in the past month, their relationship had matured swiftly, as swiftly, almost, as it would crumble. After Malcolm left, Rudy and Sam Saxon returned from Chicago. They arrived with a message for Cassius. During the Savior's Day convention, Saxon told Captain Joseph all about Malcolm's maneuvering in Miami. Joseph shook his head in disgust, convinced that the suspended minister was trying to manipulate Clay. Elijah, he told Saxon, had already determined that Malcolm would never return to the nation. Malcolm was an outcast, a marked man, with one foot in the grave. Send word to Cassius, Joseph instructed. He better not get too close to Malcolm.
And that is where we will conclude. We'll pick up next week. We'll be on chapter 13, and I think we will have 3 sessions, and we should be all done. I'm looking at the page numbers. I could be in error about that, but I'm looking at 3, and we should be all done. Anywho, really quick before we get in, the caller said, anyone who has not shared at all, you should dial in and we'll get you first. The number is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Really quick, before we get in, Manning Marble's book, Malcolm X, the bio that was done a few years back, where I said this is one of the books that's referenced in Blood Brothers, where they talk about this, their theory that Minister Malcolm, his plan for getting back into the Nation of Islam, being reinstated, included after Muhammad Ali, well, at the time, Cassius Clay, after he wins the heavyweight championship, that he could deliver him to Elijah Muhammad and on the condition that he be reinstated. So this is from Manning Marble's book. He writes, Malcolm primarily saw his role as Clay's spiritual mentor. No one gave the brash pretender any chance of winning, yet Malcolm reassured Clay that his impending victory had been prophesied centuries earlier. Clay's win, he predicted, would not only be a triumph for the Nation of Islam, but for 700 million Muslims across the globe. But Malcolm's continuing fascination with Clay and the outcome of this particular bout was at least in part influenced by his problematic status inside the nation. The fight would be held only one day prior to the annual Savior's Day convention, and here Malcolm saw an opportunity. He contacted Chicago headquarters and offered a deal. He would accompany Clay, once victorious over Liston, directly to Chicago to appear at the convention in return for his full reinstatement. Chicago rejected the offer in part because officials still doubted Clay's boxing abilities, but primarily because by late February, they had no intention of allowing Malcolm back in. I'll have to check Judas Factor, some of the other texts, to see if they have the same claim, but that is at least one source which substantiates the theory that Minister Malcolm, that was a part of his plan to see if he could get Cassius Clay to help him get back into the NOI. We'll hit the phone lines. Let me see if anybody we missed. I don't see the caller dial in before that we hadn't heard from. You should get your hand up now and not lollygag and wait till the last minute. If you have comments that you want to share, if you didn't get to share it during the first audio segment, go ahead, get your hand up right now, and we'll get you on the line. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Can I be heard? Oh, go ahead, Thomas.
I'm going to be real brief. I think that what you just said, Gus, is logical. You know, I think that if anyone knows the inner workings of the NOI, it would probably be Malcolm X. And he probably knew that that was his only chance of getting back in good graces, because I'm sure that he realized that there's certain people around Elijah Muhammad that had it out for him, and they had his ear. So I think that that is probably logical that, you know, that was, you know, a desperate man trying to get back into good graces of an organization he was in and built up so prominently, to not use him. But he probably thought that his relationship with him would ultimately get him back into good graces. I'm in my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to chime in on that too, because actually I found the book and I found that part. I did check Paul Evans's book on the page 211 that he referenced there. It does not speak anything about that whatsoever. It actually reinforces some of the FBI information that they put in the book. It actually speaks nothing to that whole concept. What I noticed about Marable's book is that he didn't give it this overtone as if Malcolm was trying to use him as the shield to save his life or prolong his life in any way. He basically presented it exactly the way Thomas in New York talked about it, as far as him trying to potentially get back in Elijah's good graces, which makes sense. But another thing about Marable's book, because there was another book written by a collective of black authors refuting his book because of the fact that they said he put a lot of things that were not qualified with any sort of footnotes. And I noticed that section doesn't have a footnote on it. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense what he wrote, and I like the way that he wrote it, but I would still like to find out what the other book that we're not able to look at right now says about it, or if anything else speaks about that, because I noticed this isn't footnoted at all. So I don't know if he heard that somewhere, or if that's something he developed based on his research. So yeah, but it makes perfect sense, and it's not something that's negative. Whereas in the white people's book, they're basically trying to paint Malcolm as a coward, or as this guy trying to, you know, use him almost as a human shield to prolong his life, which was far from the case. So, yeah, this is very interesting. But I know on 211 in Carl Evans's book, there's nothing that alludes to this whatsoever. To get to the text, the authors practice like legendary racism in this text, this particular reading. At the very beginning of chapter 12 on page 196, they write, she was one of the foxes that seemed to form the wallpaper of his life. And I just found that one sentence where they depicted this woman, even though they're quoting something that at the time Cassius Clay used to describe black women as foxes, so they're quoting that. But the fact that they would even equate her to wallpaper, again, that dehumanization factor, and it's very subtle, but it's very profound if you're paying attention to the racism practiced by these white authors. There was another section, oh yes, this is on page 203, where they also, let me see, they were also practicing racism. It says towards the bottom of the page, his race, it was that and even more than his words that lent a cutting edge to the conference. And this is when he was at a conference speaking about the Sonny Liston fight. And I just find that that's not in quotes. There's no footnote there. But yet they're the ones who were saying his race. It was that, even more than his words, that lent a cutting edge to the conference. So in other words, it was the fact that he was black that these authors are saying. This is the author's opinion, because there is no quotes, like I said, or a footnote, that lent a cutting edge. What about being black lends a cutting edge to a conference? I would love to ask them that. On the following page, they write again, instead of displaying his usual 150-watt eyes and P.T. Barnum mouth, he began talking in a quiet voice, his eyes focused on his feet, speaking barely above the sound of a soft wind makes rustling through the leaves of a tree. Again, this is not quoted. This is what they're describing, and what they're describing to me is a person in blackface. When you say 150-watt eyes, you can see at the first museum of Jim Crow racist memorabilia, they have thousands of images of black men with bulging eyes, and the P.T. Barnum mouth is some of the imagery that they used to use in P.T. Barnum's show were derogatory images of black people. And again, this is not quoted, so this is coming directly from the authors. The racism, like I said, is legendary. On the following page, they wrote something else that I found to be telling. And this was actually partially quoted from Muhammad Ali. It says, then without directly answering the question, he defended the Nation of Islam and addressed the expectations of white Americans. I believe in Allah and in peace. I don't try to move into white neighborhoods. I don't want to marry a white woman. I was baptized when I was 12, but I didn't know what I was doing. I am not a Christian anymore. As for the nation, I go to a black Muslim meeting and what do I see? I see that there's no smoking and no drinking, and the women wear dresses down to the floor. And when I come out on the street, and then I come out on the street, and you tell me I shouldn't go there. Well, there must be something in there if you don't want me to go there. And I find that telling, because I've always said about white supremacy, and you said this too, Gus, and I'm sure a couple other people have alluded to this, when you get the ire of whites, anything that agitates them means that you're going in the correct direction. Now, that direction might be fatal, depending on the white people that you're dealing with, but the idea is that anything that they're against is the best thing for you, and that tends to be how the system of white supremacy works, because they don't want us to be black self-respecting people. They want us to be the same automatons of white supremacy that they brutalized us and conditioned us to be. On the following page, there's only two more things and I'll be done. Oh, actually, three and I'll be done. On page 206, it says, cobbled from the teaching of Elijah Muhammad and the rhetoric of Malcolm X, Cassius had made variations in his speech before, but never as the heavyweight champion, a position of some authority. I find that that's the author practicing racism as well, because any young black person reading this book would get to believe that, I guess, going into sports in some fashion and becoming some sort of champion is going to give you some authority as a black person when he has no authority. All it does is just give him a platform because people will allow him to speak publicly or get in front of a camera and make statements. But there's no authority that comes with being a heavyweight champion except that you just the control of the ring and you being looked at as the best in the world, if that's the case. On page 208, they say, seeing Cassius talk with Malcolm X made reporters ask the new champion if Muhammad's statement about his membership in the nation was accurate. That is true, and I am proud of it, he answered. But what's all the commotion about? The commotion was about the country's fears, fears of a religion most Americans knew little about, fears that the Muslims were a black menace lurking in the shadows, fears that Elijah Muhammad intended to lead a violent uprising, and fears that Cassius Clay was the boogeyman in the closet. Now, I find that to be interesting because all throughout the book, we've learned about Elijah Muhammad trying to avoid any contact with the FBI or the federal government and how he directed Malcolm basically to not be who he wanted to be in order to keep that scrutiny to a minimum, but yet they believe that he was a menace. Then the description of Clay as a boogeyman, black men being menaces in the shadows. This reminds me of Lothrop Stoddard, because in his book, he basically speaks about one of the main things that they allude to in the early 1900s was the rise of the Islamic faith, and this being particularly a non-white religion was something that they had to stop at all costs. So I find that to be very telling because they have a similar position. And the final thing I wanted to touch on is on page 209. They say white men were not the only ones blinded by Cassius. In their private moments together between the minister's lectures and lessons, during their conversations and laughter, Malcolm came to believe in their friendship, their brotherhood, their bond. He rarely trusted any man, and few ever visited his home for family dinners the way that Cassius did. Malcolm fell for Clay's boyish wonder, his innocence and charm. Never did he imagine that Clay would hurt him. He trusted his own eyes, seeing only what he wanted to see, a magnetic young man full of conviction and sincerity. So to me, if you see a man full of conviction and sincerity, essentially, if that's what Malcolm saw, then I can't see him looking to use him in a derogatory manner. I could see, like I said with the Marable text, how Cassius would have played a role. But they're even describing his feelings for him as him seeing him as a person with conviction and sincerity. Then I find that they kind of homosexualized their relationship by saying he fell for Clay's boyish wonder, his innocence and charm. These are things to me that seem like a homosexualizing of the way that they tried to say that Malcolm viewed him, and I found that to be very telling as well. And thank you very much for taking my call. I'll mute my line.
Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary they want to get in.
I had a couple of things that I wanted to bring up. It said that on page 203, Clay's words prompt reporter Jack Kofert to respond, he probably will never become a great fighter because a man with his ridiculous egoism isn't likely to learn. This man is neither a credit to the game he plays nor his race. And I found that with white people, you know, they have this image that they want their blacks to portray, and then they have a tendency to start saying whether you are a credit to your race or not. You know, that's based upon how you relate to them or what your attitude is towards white people. And then John Lipsy, New York Times report kept the moment when the world of sports and politics collided. There was a trace of antagonism when Clay refused to play the mild and socially
uninvolved fourth-hero stereotype and began to use the news conference as a platform for social political theory. You know, that may be a point when someone comes to a realization or they have, you know, an awakening where they are aware of what's really going on. And then white people use that as a way to try to say that you are getting away from the sport, you're becoming politically or socially conscious, which is taken away from the game or whatever. Anything to speak negative of a black person's journey towards enlightenment. And then last, it was saying, you know, when Malcolm was having breakfast in the Hampton House with Cassius Clay, and, you know, it said that he realized that he really didn't know, he really didn't realize who Cassius really was, or that he really didn't know him. And it was insinuating that Malcolm was trying to use him, like Roz pointed out. I don't think that a person who had that much love and respect for someone then would turn around and at the same time be using them for some type of, you know, plan that he had in order to get himself back into the good graces of Elijah Muhammad. But I'll mute my line on that. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure. Any other folks that we have not heard from have commentary they want to get in, please do not wait till the last minute. If you have comments you want to share. I'll check one more time before we get to the end of the program. This is Peter Goldman's book, The Death and Life of Malcolm X. Now, this is another suspected racist author, white male. His book's a little bit older. He actually had contact with Minister Malcolm before his assassination and then went on to write this book. And this is one of the books that's also referenced to support this notion that Minister Malcolm had some sort of agenda to get back into the NOI via Muhammad Ali. So on page 128 of Goldman's book, he writes, Florida was a release for Malcolm. He spent time with his family, whom he felt he had woefully neglected. He warmed himself in the celebrity glow, the swirl of Jim Brown's and Joe Lewis's and George Plimpton's, eddying around a heavyweight fight camp. He poked around the beach like any tourist, taking the sun, snapping photos, buying picture postcards of dressed-up chimpanzees to send to his friends back home. Negro leaders, Gloria Dandridge's card said, could learn something from these monkeys who have more freedom in America than Negroes do, and these monkeys haven't had to wait for civil rights legislation. Maybe our leaders should let these monkeys lead us, Brother Malcolm X. Unfortunately, that is all in quotes. But his gathering war of nerves with Chicago went on, and even Clay became briefly a pawn between them. Clay had completed the requirements for membership in the Nation, but the hierarchy, out of the discretion of men of power, elected to hold up his registration and his original name until they saw how the fight came out. Malcolm had by then persuaded not only Clay, but himself, that Liston could be conquered, and had begun dreaming, for all his sentence to limbo, of what a gloriously marketable property the heavyweight championship would be for the Nation. Thus transported, he called Chicago and offered to deliver Clay, title and all, to the Savior's Day Convention there the day after the big fight. His price was his own reinstatement. Chicago, still unconvinced of Clay's possibilities, turned the deal down. Clay, in the event, was not really Malcolm's to offer. The night he beat Liston, Chicago telephoned him at his victory party, on Ice Cream Social, more accurately, in Malcolm's motel suite, and awarded him his membership and his new name. The next morning, reborn Muhammad Ali, he confirmed his conversion to the world. Malcolm liked Ali too well to interfere in this or to involve him further in his private difficulties. When he broke with the nation 2 weeks later, he counseled Ali to stay with Mr. Muhammad and swallowed his hurt feelings when Ali took his advice. This is a little bit further ahead than we are with this speak of the text, but that is stark to keep that in mind in terms of how it's described in this text, Blood Brothers, in terms of how the authors, Johnny Smith, Randy Roberts, how they describe the falling apart of this relationship. But this sounds substantially different, not like someone who has some sort of Machiavellian scheme, who would love to get back within the Nation of Islam and continue his work, but certainly has so much regard in terms of his relationship with Muhammad Ali that he's not trying to do any scheming or anything devious. If he can do that, fine. And once he sees that that's not a possibility, is encouraging him to go on. And I'm not going to contaminate your development, your evolution with what you're doing, and I'll just move on and swallow my pride, as they said there. But that's from Peter Goldman, The Death and Life of Malcolm X, who was also a racist suspect. Moving back to Blood Brothers, some of the things, pause for James Baldwin, the quote that they include at the beginning of the book, the power of the white world is threatened whenever a black man refuses to accept the white world's definitions. Fantastic sentence from the legend James Baldwin. The metaphors, I think we've talked about when they're talking about his ice cream social victory party, where they write that Muhammad Ali wolfed down his ice cream. He couldn't just, you know, eat it or be excited or whatever. He's got to be compared to some sort of canine. Let's see, the next one, Jim Brown, the legend, where they quote him directly from his autobiography, where he writes, I'm skeptical of white men. He would later write in his autobiography, because even the best of them want me to be patient, to follow Martin Luther King's advice and turn the other cheek until God knows when. I'm surprised that this didn't get described as tortured logic as well. Let's see. The portion where they read, I think I said something about this after the first audio segment, where it might have been a tad a bit, at least a bit more enjoyable listening to the audiobook if they had a black narrator, where they're quoting Cassius Clay when he says, I just played with him, just played with him. That sounded tortured, hearing this white narrator try to read this portion and put on some sort of pretend Negro dialect. I thought that was pretty excruciating to hear. We get the same description again, referring to black people as being some sort of creatures from this sci-fi movie, the pod people, where they say R.T. Robinson, when he came in and saw that the, or at least one white reporter was there after Cassius Clay had won the championship, he's like, what is he doing here? And he says, they write, but Archie Robinson prompted a wholly different vibe. It was like the invasion of the body snatchers. Cassius seemed like one of them, one of the pod people. And again, this is not in quotes. This is not a reference. This is the author's interpretation, where, again, the dehumanization of black people. Let's see. I thought it was significant where they describe Cassius Clay as having rude, arrogant speech, which is in quotes, but then it's not in quotes when they say they describe him as having these mean, bitter tirades, where he's telling, calling the white reporters hypocrites, and that, what do you have to say now? In this climate, again, this is just months after those four little girls were bombed in Birmingham, Alabama, that a black male calling accurately reporters hypocrites for now coming in and wanting to gawk and talk to him and get quotes after they weren't even preparing to talk to him after the fight. They were preparing to go to the hospital to see him after he's been nearly killed by Sonny Liston, and they were totally wrong. He gets just described as some bitter nigra, and is so arrogant. I think Roz captured that accurately as well. And it just continues where they say that Clay would never be a great fighter because he has so much ridiculous ego, and whites can come out and do the same thing in this same era, when you can have Joe Namath can come out and brag and boast and predict that they're going to win the Super Bowl. He's an icon. He's a legend. Wow. He's so confident. When a black person does it, it's just some cheeky, uppity Nigra, and we can't wait till he loses. Typical under the system of white supremacy. You even hear that now. I think 2016 we heard that with Cam Newton at the Super Bowl. I know I heard that from whites in reference to Cam Newton. Whenever I hear P.T. Barnum, where they were saying that now Cassius Clay, and you can't win. If you come out and you're confident and you're loud promoting yourself, you're some arrogant loudmouth Nigra. If you come out and you're quiet and humble, it's, oh man, he's not acting like a clown. What's going on here? He's not being all wide mouthed and shouting, and he's not being like P.T. Barnum. Whenever I hear P.T. Barnum, I think white slave owner. We've talked about him before in the program. He bought Joyce Heth, black female, put her body on display. That was in Medical Apartheid book that we just read. That's the first thing I think of. I don't think most people associate P.T. Barnum with white enslaver of black people, but you should. There's ample scholarship, undeniable. That's what I thought. And I still had the same association with this metaphor of associating black people with animals. When I think of circuses, I think of elephants and tigers and lions and all these animals. It's the same type, at least for me, veiled association of black people with animals of some sort, animals and clowns. I think that also goes with circuses. I thought it was great, the response when they asked Cassius Clay if he was a member of the Nation of Islam. And he says, card carrying, what does that mean? Just great, always asking questions and specifically asking about definitions of terms, going back to the way this chapter begins with a quote from James Baldwin. Last thing I get in, the quote about Jackie Robinson, where all of this is... as he listened to Clay's answers, he heard his voice grow stronger, bolder, and more defiant. There was no other athlete in America who so audaciously challenged the politics of the sports world. Clay is the finest Negro athlete I've ever known, Malcolm asserted. The man who will mean more to his people than any athlete before him. He is more than Jackie Robinson was, because Robinson is the white man's hero, but Cassius is the black man's hero. Do you know why? Because the white press wanted him to lose. They wanted him to lose because he is a Muslim. You notice nobody cares about the religion of other athletes, but their prejudice against Clay blinded them to his ability, specifically about Jackie Robinson being the white man's hero. I know many black people are not pleased with Jackie Robinson for whatever reason. That is a book. Jackie Robinson has his own books that he wrote. He has his own autobiography, which is fascinating. I would encourage folks to read. We should maybe do that down the road. But white people were certainly not rooting for Jackie Robinson when he came into baseball in 1947. That is well documented. The death threats against he, his wife, his black children, the Klan making an attempt on him in Sanford, Florida, where Trayvon Martin was killed. That is, I mean, just by the record, this is not my opinion or certainly disagreeing with Minister Malcolm. He has VGQ, but just the record, that is not accurate. It is well documented. White people wanted Jackie Robinson to fail and made this clear. Even his own teammates talking about boycotting and we're not going to play and we don't want this nigger here. That went on and on and on well beyond his first year in the league in 1947. In my view, there's a lot of revisionist history. A lot of people don't know about Jackie Robinson in detail now, and whites can just give you the picture that he was a well-behaved Negro and he didn't complain, and whites called him nigger and everything else that they wanted to, and he didn't do anything and just turned the other cheek. When you learn more about Jackie Robinson, I think people will have a much just appreciation, I'll put it that way, for what he endured as a victim of white supremacy, who was certainly, I think it is as far from accurate as you can get to describe Jackie Robinson as white people's champion at any point during his playing career, in my opinion. And I would even take that back, not in my opinion, according to the record, if you look at the history yourself, not Gus's opinion, according to the record. I will stop there. Final comment before we wrap things up. Are everyone good?
You know, one point I wanted to make was what these authors are doing by adding this stuff in the book that isn't documented or, you know, can't be confirmed is something that white people do all the time. And it's very confusing, because what ends up happening is they put all this good information in there that can be validated, and then you slide these things, your opinion, in the middle, and those things the people will think is just as valid as the stuff that's been validated. And then your book becomes a reference point for someone else who's writing the next book, and they're quoting you, and it's making this stuff look like it happened that never happened. And I really hate when they do that. And I'm glad that you've been pointing that out. I'll meet my line. Thank you, Gus.
For sure. Dr. Marimba Ani talks about that in Yerugu, the cumulative effect of racist writing, where they can just go and say, well, oh, we have it in 20 different books, where they write a book and then they quote each other, reference each other, that sort of thing. I think Dr. Tommy Curry, that's why he encourages us to, as an act of counter-racism, to reference black authors when we are writing. We have somebody can comment quickly, like 30 seconds, or if we're satisfied, that's fine. Anybody 30-second comment they think they can do?
Sure. I think what you just said and what Thomas alluded to really sinks in the fact that we should all be writing, like all of us, as many of us as possible who have that particular skill or who are inclined to do so. Like us telling our own stories is really essential, because in situations like what you discussed, where they're writing all of this information, they're infusing their racism, white supremacy, and then they're quoting each other. So they have a monopoly on how our story is being told. And the only way to change that is for us to take over and start writing our own stories and speaking on the issues ourselves and putting that information out there. Thank you very much for that, Gus. And Thomas.
For sure. We will pick up there. I think it's three. There could not be any more than three sessions left. It might be fewer than that, but certainly no more than three, and we'll be done. One of our listeners, incidentally, if anybody just wants this book to have in your library as a study in racism, white supremacy, one of the more skilled ways that whites do what they do in their war against black people, one of our listeners bought the book, and she was so disgusted by it, she said she was willing to give it away. If any listener wants the book, she will send it to you for free just to get rid of it. I think she had said she was going to, I guess, put it on Amazon or whatever the case. But if somebody, a Cal's listener, wants it, she said she would be willing to give it up for free if you would like to have it in your library. So you can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, and let me know if you would like. This is a hard copy of Blood Brothers, and one of our listeners will hook you up. We will be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what has gone down over the last 7 days. Always an interesting week on the plantation. Also, we'll do our monthly global Sunday talk on racism. That'll be this coming Sunday, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Interesting time, because as I've stated, not only did we just have the 2-year anniversary of everything that went down in Ferguson in 2014, but this is the 4-year anniversary of the Marikana mining strike in South Africa. I'm not sure if folks in this part of the world have focused on that or paid attention to that, but that has been big news in South Africa this month. It is also the 5-year anniversary of the quote-unquote London riots that happened after the police killing of Mark Duggan in 2011. That has been significant news in London. It'll certainly be good to hear thoughts from some of our listeners in the UK about what transpired with that, as well as their thoughts on some of the things that have been happening worldwide with the Olympics and everything else. But that'll be this Sunday. Always grand to hear from our international array of COWS listeners. If you have questions, comments, thoughts on the book for people who are listening to the archives that you want to include before we wrap up, guest suggestions, gripes, complaints, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Invest in the broadcast if you think the content is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Someone already emailed me about the book, so it looks like we have already got that off the table. So I'm just going to take the first person that emailed me and already got it. So never mind about emailing about the book. With that, I will again encourage sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We want to make sure that we are in our correct mind so we can make phenomenal decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible. Certainly, if you're in a vehicle, I know summer's winding down and you might be doing end of summer activities, going camping or going to the beach or traveling or whatever you're doing. You do not want to lax on your codification while you are having a good time. Racists certainly are not going to relax just because you are on quote unquote vacation. With that said, anytime you're in a vehicle, driver, passenger, even if you're a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence of anything. Think Renisha McBride, Trayvon Martin, the young black male who was just shot and killed in North Carolina just a few days ago. Any illustration that you need, alcohol or any other intoxicants, that is always a bad recipe. It's not going to make things better under the system of racism, white supremacy. If you're in a vehicle, make sure you buckle up every time. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. You never know when it will be your day to bump into Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw. You want to be able to survive that situation with as little damage as possible. And that is surviving whether you encounter a racist with a badge or without a badge. For sure, make sure we take it seriously. One of the worst combinations in the known universe, alcohol and whites. That's it, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.